is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
McCoy at the 10, at the 5, into the end zone. Touchdown! What a great run! He's in trouble. He is dropped. Kyle Williams dropped it. Oh, baby, what a hit. Tyrod looks. Tyrod on the run. Nobody in front of him. Touchdown! There's T-Mobile.
He gonna come through.
Sammy in the end zone. Got it! Got it! Touchdown! Sammy Watkins, touchdown, Buffalo! McCoy, punch to the right. Outrunning everybody. 10, 5, touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown, Buffalo!
Live from One Bills Drive, this is the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts.
And welcome to the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts, a Monday edition. Chris Brown with you again, in for John Murphy, who's taking a nice long weekend during the summer months, as you can understand.
He is.
Donald Jones alongside me again, as always. How was your weekend? How was Father's Day weekend for you?
Father's Day was good, you know. Aside from the fact that it rained back home in New Jersey.
Okay.
I had a soccer game. I had to go to my son's soccer game.
Nice.
And it was like pouring down rain out there. And they didn't want to end it because I think it was their last game, number one. There was no, like, thunder and lightning.
Yeah,
so
as long as there's no lightning, you're good.
Yeah, you know. And I'm dad, so dad has to stand out there with him. Mm-hmm. I can't go running to the car and sit and watch from the car. That's not what a dad is supposed to do. So I stood out there. I didn't have an umbrella or anything. It was like a rookie move.
Yeah. I had a lot of soccer as well. I was at a tournament coaching a couple of teams, and I have the most wicked farmer's tan after this weekend that you can possibly imagine. And it's worse on my legs than on my arms.
Yeah.
The back of my legs must have been facing the sun on the sidelines the whole weekend because you lift up where the shorts end, and it's very evident that that did not see the light of day all weekend. It is bad. It is really, really bad.
Now, any burn or it
no,
doesn't hurt anything?
I did
right?
Okay.
Just tan? Okay.
I'm a little darker up top, a little redder up top here, but I had 70 on this weekend, and it was really humid here. It was like 87 on Saturday, and it was like 80% humidity, and you're standing out in the sun where there's no shade. You know, you got 15, 20 soccer fields out there. You're ready to pay somebody for a shady tree to stand under.
Yeah, see, I think I was supposed to be fat, you know, because I I'm telling you, I think I was supposed to be fat. I mean, I sweat a lot, you know. And
that's why I don't wear hats, because if I can't wear a hat, I sweat
four sweat
times
too much.
As much.
Yeah, but see, like I don't like when the sun is just beaming down right in my eyes on my face. So I wear hats, but I just sweat like it's the worst. The summertime is that's why I like spring and
struggle.
Fall. Summertime is a struggle for me.
See, I like summer. I'll deal with it. I'll never complain that it's too hot. It's the humidity. That's
that
what
is
they
the
always
thing,
say.
Humidity.
It's not the heat, it's the humidity.
And that's what gets you. Because if you go out to California, I mean, there's nothing like, or Arizona or something, it's nothing like over here.
Now, I am going to spring this on you a little bit with some help of the guys behind the scenes on our production end here. But I saw one of your tweets over the weekend, and, you know, you were doing a nice little happy Father's Day thing to your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at the photo, and I almost fell out of my chair because Donald Jones looks exactly like his dad. The only difference is his dad has gray hair and a gray beard.
That's
the
only
smile
difference.
Is exactly the same. The eyebrows are exactly the same. The eyes, the nose, the cheekbones, they're all identical. It is uncanny. That's basically what you're going to look like in 30 years.
Yeah, I know.
Because
I'm already going gray now, so I know I'm going to look like my dad. And
people tell me I look like my dad. It is nothing compared to this side-by-side photo, and our MSG viewers are watching this. But if you haven't seen this photo and you want to see it, our radio listeners should just go to Donald's Twitter handle to see it. It is spitting image. You know how you do that thing on the computer?
Mm-hmm.
Like 30 years later, this is what you could look like?
Right.
You don't need to do that.
Just look at my
dad,
right?
You have to get that a lot, right?
Oh, I get it all the time. Yeah.
It is crazy.
All the time, yeah.
If
he wasn't gray, it would be like, wow, are y'all twins?
Yeah, I mean, he gets some Just for Men, and he's you.
Right. But he would never dye his hair, ever.
No?
No. Because our whole family, everybody's gray, and he just embraced it. He started going gray about 32. By the time he was 37, he was fully gray.
I was stunned. I almost fell out of my chair. I was just cruising on Twitter yesterday, and I was like, holy cow. I could not believe it. Now, does he still live down there in Jersey?
Yeah, he's still down in Jersey. I was hanging with him yesterday. I thought I was going over to hang with him. He's like, hey, I need you to help me move these couches. I'm like, what? I didn't come over here to work, man. I came over here to
lounge
chill.
Around. It is Father's Day, you know. Let's...
Nah, he wanted to do some work, so whatever.
The best one for me is, so we have Father's Day weekend, you know, so I didn't have a lot to do outside of, you know, the tournament and everything with the kids. And I wake up Monday morning. I go into the office in the house. There is like a honey-do list, maybe as long as my arm.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I think the weekend's over.
Right.
Time to get some stuff done this week. I guess we'll be puttering around the house a lot for the next couple of weeks. It didn't last long. So take advantage of it for the dads when you have that Father's Day weekend and somebody says, oh, no, and let me get that for you. Say, okay, put your feet up and soak it up because it's over quick.
It is.
It is over quick.
All right, your day is over. Time to get back to work.
But we got some good stuff on the show today. A couple of fun guests that we'll be talking to a little bit later on. At 1 o'clock, we've got Kevin Gilbride, former Bills offensive coordinator during those Drew Bledsoe years, especially 2002 when they were airing the ball out a ton, throwing Eric Moles, Peerless Price. And, you know, you look at that offense and how successful it was, at least for the first half of 2002. They came off to a roaring start and scoring 30, 40 points a game. It was a lot of fun to watch. So we'll catch up with him because Kevin is no longer coaching in the NFL, but he's doing some coaching clinics and just finished one over Father's Day weekend as part of an NFL initiative. So we want to talk to him about that as well because he's doing some nice stuff, along with a couple of other former Bills coaches who are also part of that program. So we're going to catch up with Kevin, maybe also talk to him a little bit about the top 10 offensive players of all time for the Bills, knowing he probably coached one of them in Eric Moles, because that show airs tonight on MSG at 9 p.m. So we want to get his thoughts on that and what he remembers about Eric's career. And then at 2 o'clock, we've got our good pal Lorenzo Alexander. He's going to join us on Skype, and we'll be talking to him. It's an interesting thing that got written. It's also in our Bills Today on BuffaloBills.com today, an advanced metric where Lorenzo ranks very high based on his performance from 2016. So we look forward to catching up with him. Boy, we didn't give him much time either, huh? He just had his last day of work last Thursday.
Lorenzo,
we're ringing him up on the Skype line here.
We need
on
to
Monday.
Talk to you, Lorenzo. But Lorenzo likes this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And it's evident that he would like to be in the media once he's done. I think he would want to continue his duties with the NFLPA. He's very big, very involved in that, but I think he really wants to get into the media. Like, he has his own setup and everything at his house at home that I guess he bought all of this equipment and stuff. He really goes to the next level with it.
Yeah.
But the last time we tried to get him on, it didn't work. So, you know, I might have to give him some stuff for that.
We'll have to check in with him. But one of the things we wanted to start with right off the bat was an interesting piece that showed up online that some people came across, including our producer, Jay Harrison. You know, interesting that people are trying to dissect this already across the league. But basically what was done was ESPN ran a story and they projected every NFL club's most important game on their 2017 schedule. And some of these picks were not the games that I think a lot of people would have anticipated them to be.
Right.
You know, a lot of people would just say, "Wow, it's division games. Got to win the division," you know. But I think the conversation is a little bit different, especially for the Bills and the other AFC East teams, knowing the stranglehold that the New England Patriots have had on the division. So ESPN.com, in picking the Bills' toughest game on the schedule, went with their – or I shouldn't say toughest game, most important game in terms of how it's going to impact their season. They went with Week 5, October 8th, at Cincinnati. Now, just at first blush, how does that grab you?
In Cincinnati? To me, it doesn't really make sense to me. I would be one of those people that would say, you got to win your division games as well. Now, I do understand where they're coming from because Cincinnati's a team that is typically right around the playoffs, if not in the playoffs. But I think I would go with this year one of those teams that you're going to play out in the AFC West because the AFC West, if you talk about last year's schedule, I mean, they had three teams that were right around the playoffs in Denver, Kansas City, and Oakland, you know, they went all the way down to the wire with it. So I would think that one of those teams would be in the wild card if we're talking about a wild card berth, and they would be one of the teams that you need to beat.
Yeah, I'm going to read what ESPN.com wrote in assessing the Bengals game in Week 5 for the Bills, which is in Cincinnati, why they feel it's the most important as it relates to their football power index projections. So they say the Bills' best chance at the postseason, per the football power index, is as a wild card, meaning a win over a Bengals team that has a football power index has among its most likely wild card participants would go a long way, especially considering tiebreakers, mainly because the Patriots are projected to run away with the AFC East, which is something we addressed briefly here already. Buffalo is the only NFL team whose highest leverage game falls outside its division. So they went strictly with analytics here in making this decision. However, this football power index is constructed analytically. It's saying for the Bills, it's not a division game. They're going strictly by these analytics. They say you win over the Bengals, you give yourself an extra 14.8% leverage to make the playoffs. So it's almost a 15% spike in chances of reaching the postseason if you win this Week 5 game over the Bengals. Now, what other – you also got 15 other games to play, by the way. But so, you know, we didn't delve into just how this FPI is constructed, but it's an interesting take that it's not a division game.
I would think that they're saying that Cincinnati is going to be a wild card team.
I think they're projecting similar success for them and that this will be a key tiebreaker for whoever wins this game. Let me see who they picked for Cincinnati because that might tell us something too. They have a division game for them. They've got their key game last week of the season against the Ravens in Baltimore. So they claim that the Week 17 matchup in Baltimore may end up in a win and in scenario for both teams, which jives with the fact that the Bengals' best chance to make the playoffs per FPI relies on winning this game. They're saying it's a 53.3% chance if they do win the game
that they'll be in the playoffs.
And it's a playoff leverage swing if they win the game of 23%. Now, we can get all bogged down in the numbers. I'd prefer to just look at it at face value because that's easier for me, for you, and for our listeners at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. What do you see as the most important game on the Bills' schedule? ESPN.com says Week 5 at Cincinnati due to AFC wild card projections and implications. While it's probably premature to do any of this, I think it's a fun thing to do here in the middle of June. Because, you know, now's the time of year where, you know, a lot of Bills fans are looking at some of these games and saying, you know, maybe I want to pick a road game to go to. What could be important? You know, this Week 5 game, there's going to be a lot still in play and a lot still undetermined. And so I find it interesting that this analytic breakdown has that as the most critical game to Buffalo's playoff chances. Now, it's probably easier to say that, too, because by the time they get to Week 5, they've still only played one division game, the opener against the Jets. And then I can see a division team again until 3 weeks after the bye, and it's the Jets again. And then they don't see anybody until the last 5 weeks of the season, as Bills fans who have, you know, kind of dissected the schedule know full well. So, you know, I would still maintain that those Dolphins games are going to be pretty important because that is a team that did make the playoffs last year. You know, fought through some adversity, losing their starting quarterback to an ACL knee injury, and still kind of powered through and found their way in. Granted, they lost to the Steelers in round one of the playoffs, but I think the Dolphins are the team that, you know, the Bills are trying to stay ahead of, so they're eligible for the wild card. I want to take care of A first in my own division because the tiebreakers are a little bit different there than they are with a conference team that you might be tied with. I'm not saying you shouldn't beat Cincinnati. You need as many AFC wins as you can because conference record comes into play very quickly. But I would argue Miami, not only because they're a division team, but you got to play them twice. You beat them twice, you're in pretty good shape.
And I think that December 31st game down in Miami, you could be in the same situation as they have with Cincinnati going out to Baltimore to play them the last game of the season, because it's a win and in. And I would think the Bills and the Dolphins would probably be in the same situation unless the Patriots just fall off the face of the earth. The Bills and the Dolphins would be in the same situation at that game, that last game of the season. Whoever wins this game is in the playoffs, in the last, you know, wild card slot or something like that. So I would probably say that those Dolphins games are important as well. But if you go outside the division, like I said, I would have to go out to the AFC West.
Yeah, I was wondering what team you had in mind there. Like, who were you thinking of AFC West-wise? Was there a team that kind of jumped out at you that you said, yeah, this team or this game?
I would think I like to think of things like kind of in momentum. And I would look at the November 26th game out in Kansas City.
Right.
Because, you know, if you win that game, that team is probably going to be probably a wild card or a playoff team. If you win that game, then you get some momentum going to or coming back home to play against the Patriots. And if you can beat the Patriots here in Buffalo, you protect your home turf, then you'll have the Colts, and then you'll go into that last three-game stretch, you know. So I think that Chiefs game is a game that you need to win to make sure that you keep momentum as you go into that AFC East stretch.
And that's a game because it seems like the Bills play Kansas City almost every year, and it almost always seems to be in November, and it almost always seems to be a situation where it's the Bills have to have this game to stay ahead of some other AFC competitors for a wild card berth, and almost every time the Bills come up short in that game. You know, I still remember the game out in Kansas City where Bills get up early, Sammy's cutting them up, you know, getting behind the defense, scores a couple of touchdowns. They've got a first-half lead, and they can't hold on to it, end up losing that game in a horrible weather game, by the way. It was rainy and cold. It's like 38 in rain. But it seems that every year the game that you're referencing is one where the Bills have come up short. Now, could it be different this year? Certainly could. And it comes, what is that, 6 weeks after the bye. So it's like right in the middle of that back half of the schedule. And it's right around Thanksgiving, which always seems to be the case. There's always some kind of November game with Kansas City. And unfortunately, it's knocked the Bills' season off the rails as far as playoff hopes have gone the last several times that they've had to play them in the regular season. What do you think? 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Do you believe the analytic gurus at ESPN.com using their football power index saying, it's Bills Cincinnati, week 5 in Cincinnati, that's going to make or break the Bills' playoff hopes for the 2017 season? Or is it another game on the schedule? 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Get on the line. Let us know what you think in terms of what game strikes you as the most important on their schedule. Naturally, getting a win over New England is something everybody would like to have.
Yeah.
The Bills got one last year against a team playing its third-string quarterback up in New England last year, a 16-0 shutout win. In the end, it didn't mean a whole lot because they finished 8-8. You know, I think a lot of people are going to make an argument for division games, but as the ESPN.com piece, you know, astutely pointed out, a lot of people are saying New England's going to run away with the division again. And with the way they've reloaded in the offseason, and as long as they've got number 12 a quarterback, it's very hard to argue that because – you know, what's going to turn that for them? I think even with catastrophic injuries that they've had in the past, whether it was Brady himself in 08, they went 11-5. Gronk's been in and out of the lineup for long stretches. It has an impact in them. And you can make the argument that they've made themselves deeper, definitely at the running back position. You know, they have Gillislee. They signed Rex Burkhead away from Cincinnati. You know, another multifaceted back to team up with James White and Deion Lewis. I mean, they've got a full stable.
They brought in a receiver from
multi-dimensional backs. Right. And then Brandon Cooks in the trade. So they're deeper wide receiver. So, I mean, offensively, they've reloaded. Defensively, we all know about the Gilmore acquisition in free agency. They're stronger at cornerback now. So, you know, they look like a deeper team on paper. And we know that they're one of the most consistent teams in terms of execution every year. So you have to say, okay, I get the projections. I understand why. So where do you go after New England? To me, I go to Miami because I think if you finish ahead of Miami, much like the Dolphins finished ahead of the Bills last year, you're giving yourself at least a chance to be in that wild card conversation. You've eliminated the other division opponents. Now you're just hoping you've done better than the other AFC teams in other divisions. I mean, for those that don't remember, the playoff teams last year in the AFC, New England obviously wins the East, Pittsburgh wins the North, Houston wins the South on tiebreaker over Tennessee with a 9-7 record. Tennessee was also 9-7, did not get in as a wild card. Kansas City, the AFC West winner on tiebreaker over the Raiders, who slipped at the end, finished 12-4, but was a wild card. So the Dolphins and the Raiders were the two wild card teams, and that's kind of how it went there. So, you know, there were teams right there behind them, you know, as we mentioned, Raiders 12-4, Tennessee 9-7 on a tiebreaker. Nobody else was really better than 8-8, except for the Denver Broncos, who finished 9-7, but were a distant third in the AFC West because of the two 12-4 clubs in Oakland and Kansas City. How much of that changes this year?
You don't know.
You don't know.
We just don't know. For me, when you look at the Bills' schedule and you look at the last five games, you have four divisional games in the last five games. You need to be on a roll going into those games. You don't need to be in a situation where it's like, man, you got to win, you know, X amount of games, three of these next five. You need to just be on a roll going in to play the Patriots or coming back home December 3rd to play the Patriots, because we all know the Patriots, once you get into December, I mean, they're rolling. They are like all cylinders moving forward. They are rolling, and it's tough to beat them at that point in the year. So you need to be rolling as well. So for me, I look at that Kansas City game, which, like you said, they play out there a lot in November. I don't know why. They always seem to play out there. I don't know what's going on at the NFL.
Whoever's
doing the scheduling.
Yeah, I think it's been 3 years now since they've been here. Well, I mean, they were going to play the Chiefs no matter what, because the AFC West is the intra-conference slate that's up on the rotation this year for the Bills, because they're playing the Chargers, the Raiders. They get the Raiders at home. Mm-hmm. They've got to play the Chargers out west, and they get the Broncos here.
So you would think, I mean, the Chiefs, I would think, would be a good team, even though they've done some things out there, like they let Macklin go. I mean, they've let some guys go off that team that would make you wonder what's going on out there.
No more Jamal Charles.
Right, exactly. What's going on out there? But at the same time, you would think they would be right back around the playoff picture, if not in the playoffs. And so you need to win that game as you go into a five-game stretch where you have four divisional games.
Yeah, here's the other thing, too, to consider. When if you're going to pick that game, and like I am, I'm kind of picking the two Miami games at the end, week 15 and week 17. I think the thing to think about also is, in year one, under head coach Sean McDermott, as ready as he's going to try to have this team at the beginning of the year, it's still new schemes on offense and defense to get adjusted to. And as much as you try to replicate game speed in the preseason games, it's still not the same as real live regular season football.
Right.
And because of that, oftentimes you don't see teams in their first year under a new head coach gain traction and playing consistently until maybe you get to that week five, six, maybe even later, depending on how quick the team is on the uptake, collectively, not individually. And so there's a chance that, based on how that often goes, and the Dolphins you can use as a perfect example, out of the gate slow in September under first-year head coach Adam Gase last year. And granted, they had a bear of a schedule. I think they were at Seattle week one. It's like,
they did.
Thanks. That's a nice welcome to the NFL for me, says Adam
Gase.
That's a rookie. And then they had a couple other road dates mixed in there. I think they had three of their first four on the road. So they were just taking their lumps that first month. But then they kind of pulled it back around. Jay Ajayi started going off, including against the Bills. And they got on a roll there. And then despite whatever adversity was getting thrown at them, injuries, Tannehill out, they were still able to kind of cobble together wins, you know. So at the end of the year, they're sitting there 10-6. Now they go in kind of a wounded duck to play the Steelers on the road in the wild card game, and it was just too much for them at that point in time. I think they had put so much in to finishing strong to get in.
Right.
I remember watching that game, feeling like they just didn't have much left to give to kind of get a playoff win. But I think it's an example of maybe what we can expect to see from the Bills. Not to say that, I mean, their schedule isn't a bear by any means in comparison to the Dolphins' schedule in 2016. I mean, they get the Jets at home, which is a team that's having a fire sale right now, really doesn't have a quarterback of any great concern.
Garage sale.
I mean, especially if Josh McCown doesn't even wind up being the starter. And then you're at Carolina. That's not an easy game by any means. 2 years removed from winning the NFC, mm-hmm. but you're home against Denver, which has got a quarterback situation that you can definitely argue is not as good as the Bills situation. And then tough one at Atlanta. Okay. And then you're at Cincinnati, mm-hmm. the game that ESPN.com is referring to. You know, if you can get out of there winning your two home games and then stealing one in Cincinnati, much like they did last year. Stole one in Cincinnati, didn't play the best game, but didn't play a mistake-filled game. Got a couple of turnovers away from Cincinnati and on two interceptions by Stephon Gilmore. Mm-hmm. But they got two takeaways, and they made it stand up. They win 16-12 last year out there. So it's certainly possible to kind of – you get out of there 3-2 to the bye. You know, you put yourself in decent position because you got three of the next four games are at home after that.
Yeah.
Granted, not against easy opponents. You got some high-octane offenses coming in. Tampa Bay, Oakland, New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are all high-flying attacks, especially – you know, Tampa Bay is getting all kinds of pub with all of the things they've added. DeSean Jackson, O.J. Howard in the draft. And they already had some pretty good weapons already in Mike Evans, even the Cameron Brake kid who had a nice – season as a tight end last year.
And Jameis is.
But if they get to the bye 3-2, 5 weeks under their belt in their new systems, extra week to prepare, you know, maybe that's where they kind of hit their stride, yeah. and it would lend a little bit more credence to where they are going into that Kansas City game at the end of November.
Right. I mean, the start of the schedule, they don't want to find themselves in a situation they did like the Dolphins did last year. I mean, where you have to win. You want to win all your games, but when you get into a situation, you start off very slow in the first month, first 5 weeks, and then the Tampa Bay game, you have to win. The Oakland game, you have to win to even just stay alive, you know, in the whole playoff picture. You need to start out kind of hot, you know, like you said, like 3-2, something like that. But how crazy would it be for Bills fans if something crazy happened out in Denver and Chad Kelly was the starter as Denver came into town?
Throwing that one out there early.
Denver came into town and Chad Kelly's the starter.
Hey, I'll say this. I don't think Paxton Lynch is a lock by any means. Some people out in Denver, the reporters, have even said you can make an argument that Chad Kelly's the most talented quarterback in the group of those three, Paxton Lynch, Trevor Siemian, in terms of just pure physical skills. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would argue that Paxton Lynch got a pretty darn good arm, too. I mean, and the kid's 6'6". And he can move for being 6'6". So I think that is one of the better quarterback battles to watch in training camps this summer, no question about it. But the bottom line is Simeon's the only guy with any real experience in the league. So that game in week 3, you have to hope that better quarterback play in Buffalo can take advantage of what you would anticipate would be more mistake-prone quarterback play with Denver in week 3 in a game you've got at home. But we're going to step aside here, 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Tell us what you think is the most important game on the Bills' schedule 2017 to kind of keep them alive in a playoff hunt. ESPN.com has their opinion. We've got ours. We want to know yours. Jake and Kenmore, hang on the line. You're going to lead us off in the next segment here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Donald Jones with you here on the John Murphy Show, filling in for Murphy here on Monday. Murph will be back tomorrow, along with Donald, presented by Napa Auto Parts. And Donald and I are knocking around an ESPN.com piece where using a football power index, the means of which we do not know how they came up with, and I don't feel like pulling out the slide rule or the compass and trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. But they've basically determined what their analytics are telling them is the most important game on every team in the NFL's schedule this year concerning their playoff hopes. And believe it or not, in a lot of cases, the key game for probably about half these teams is not a division game, and the Bills are in that boat. They argue it's week 5 at Cincinnati, saying their analytics tell them a win there in week 5 at Cincinnati would increase Buffalo's playoff leverage by almost 15%. What do you think? 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550 to join us. Got a couple of lines open for you. Donald thinks it's that game against Kansas City. What is that week? Well, it's November 26th, so 17, 16. Week 13, I believe it is. And then I'm arguing that the Miami game, week 15, and week might as 12. Well throw in the rematch in week 17. So that's where we stand. Where do you stand? We're going to go to the phones, and as promised, we're going to go to Jake in Kenmore, who's got his feelings on this one. So,
Jake from State Farm.
Is he? Is he wearing the khakis? Jake, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
What do you got for us, Jake?
I wholeheartedly believe that the Patriots are going to be our biggest problem, as they have been for many years. I believe that if we are able to overtake these guys, finally, that'll give us not only the confidence, but also to overcome the pressure to take the division and you know, give us what we need to at least get into the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that can't happen, Jake, but that's a pretty lofty goal for year one under Sean McDermott. I mean, they'll be gunning to do that, no question about it. But do you see the Patriots game as the most important on their schedule? Because, I mean, there are teams that have proven they go 4-2 in the division, have a division nemesis they can't beat, and still find a way in the playoffs. I mean, the Dolphins did that. So
indeed. And we are very and we're very capable of beating the Dolphins. We've shown so, maybe not this past season, but, you know, with that we acquired from them, he came out and just destroyed them. And I think that's possible again. I'd really like to see him become more of an integral part of the offense. In order to, you know, to take these teams in our division, and outside of that, you know, Tom Brady, as with all quarterbacks, he's getting up there, man. Every quarterback's going to see his day.
Right. Yeah, no, I hear you, Jake, and we thank you for the phone call. We do have to move along, but, you know, Brady's doing some of the most advanced body, I'm trying to find the word, sculpting, preservation techniques you can possibly imagine. I mean, this guy, somebody who is on the inside of major advances and the cutting edge of strength and conditioning, nutrition, body shaping, body sculpting, body preservation was telling me when I was down at the Senior Bowl that Tom Brady is doing things that half the league is going to be doing in 10 years.
Really?
So he's that far ahead of the curve because this guy wants to play as long as he can. People, you know, he's got 5 Super Bowls and this and that. It wouldn't shock me if this guy's got 10 in his head as, you know, the ultimate goal for him. I'm not saying he's going to do it, but if this guy's playing at 45, based on some of the stuff people have told me he does nutrition-wise, exercise-wise, everything. I mean, this guy is strict to the letter on just about every regimen he has his professional people giving him. Peter King wrote something on that, I want to say a couple of months ago, when he went up to Brady's hideaway in Montana or wherever the heck it was. Yeah. Some of the things that he's doing is completely cutting edge and revolutionary. So it's not going to shock me at all if this guy's still hanging around at 45 and doing the job. All that being said,
and he doesn't get hit. Well, I mean, that's the biggest
in
thing.
Most cases, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't. For the most part, he doesn't take hard hit. He goes down when he sees a hit coming. He will go down.
Yeah,
and I think that's big for him. That's why I don't think a guy like Aaron Rodgers will last that long. You know, nothing like where Brady will last if he wants to. Just because Aaron Rodgers likes to play outside the box, he takes a lot of hits. You know, and he has a lot of injuries every year. Brady doesn't have that same.
Yeah.
Those same type of injuries.
So it sounded like Jake was coming down on New England, you know, for the most important game for them. I think he's looking at it more with getting this team to where I think everybody wants it, and I think he believes if they can vanquish the demons that are New England, that it'll put this team on a faster track to perennial success. How realistic that is in year one remains to be seen. Not to mention the fact that you don't play them until, what is that, 17, 16, 15, 14, week 13. Who knows what their team's going to look like in week 13 based on health? Who knows what the Bills are going to look like in week 13 based on health? I think that's a very difficult game to pin down, much like the Miami games that I picked. Mm-hmm. But I think Miami and Buffalo are more closely ranked in terms of caliber of team than New England, which has proven that, once again, they were better than anybody else last year.
You ever seen the movie Joyride?
I did not.
No? I wonder if anybody in our control room out there has seen the movie Joyride. But I'm telling you, Jake sounded just like the guy in Joyride.
Oh,
like
he did.
Yeah, and Joyride is a
very slow and methodical.
Yeah, his voice was like exactly.
I was
the
like
same.
Hanging on the next word that was coming. But
his voice is definitely just like the guy from Joyride. It was a trucker that was actually killing people.
Oh, and wow, wonderful! I hope it's not him.
I hope not. But the Patriots are a tough team to play. It's a tough team to play later in the season. It really is, just because they are typically
rolling.
Once
they get in that groove, yeah.
Yeah, they're in a groove at that point. You know, you want to play them early in the season like they did last year, where they haven't really gelled together yet. But by the time you get to week 13, Brady and those boys are usually gelling. But who knows, man? The Bills could come out on fire, and you just never know.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Mike in Staten Island, who's got a take on what he feels is the most important game on the Bills' 2017 schedule concerning playoff hopes. What do you got for us, Mike?
Hey, guys. First off, I just want to say I love the show. I listen to you guys every day. You guys are great.
Thanks, you.
I think the most important game is going to be the kind of sandwiched game with the Colts in the middle of the division.
Three-game home stretch there, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also the sandwich game in a three-game home stretch down at the back half of the season. So, you know, you look at the last 5 weeks, which Mike's referring to, where you've got four division games. It goes home New England, then it's home Indy, home Miami, at New England, at Miami. Why do you feel that's the most important one, though, Mike?
Well, because I feel that's a game that the Bills have to win. If the Bills want to make the playoffs, they have to win that game, because then they're going to be playing. Then they're going to be playing the Dolphins, the Patriots, and the Dolphins. So they have to win. If not those three games, they have to win those next four. That's what I think. I mean, yeah.
So you're saying that's got to be the gimme game they have to have,
right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, I mean, and if we somehow get a win against the Patriots, that would be great, but I understand, you know, what you guys were saying earlier, but you know, with Sean McDermott, but I have faith and I'm looking forward to the season. I hope, you know.
I hear you, Mike. I hear you, and we thank you for the call and the kind words as well. We appreciate that. But the Indy's an interesting game, I think,
yeah.
And I think based on what we were getting from Mike there, I think the reason he feels they've got to have that game is because the rest of them around them are tough.
Right.
I mean, they're all division games. Two of them are against New England. We know what kind of hill that is to climb. And then Miami, as we've mentioned, was a playoff team last year. Where are they this year? It looks like Tannehill's fine to go. Never needed knee surgery. Although I believe you hit that thing once and it's probably in rough shape. But the Indy game, how does that strike you?
I mean, I can see where he's coming from. You know, that's a game where it's like, all right, you have to win this one because you have three more divisional games after that. So
right.
You need to just go ahead and take that one. It's a conference game, so you need to take that as a conference game. But, you know, people look at them as gimme games. I don't really think that anything is a gimme
right.
game. I think, you know, I could even make an argument, though, that those first three games of the season, because they are against conference opponents, the Jets, Broncos, the Jets, Broncos,
Cincinnati.
And Cincinnati, you have three of those five first games as conference games,
right.
You need to kind of get a leg up on everybody else in your conference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you get into Tampa and Oakland and kind of a rough stretch. So
you want to talk about a team that you really don't know what they're going to look like. It's probably Indianapolis. I mean, they just announced last week Frank Gore is still going to be their bell cow back. I mean, what is he, 37?
Yeah.
I think really he's 33, 34. I mean, you're really pushing the risk-reward there is leaning heavily towards risk as opposed to reward. He's been unbelievably durable over the course of his career after suffering some catastrophic knee injuries in college. His durability in the NFL has been remarkable for the position that he plays. But he's still supposed to be the bell cow back. Andrew Luck is still not throwing. They don't know if he's going to be throwing at the start of training camp, although they indicate they believe he will. He's coming off a shoulder injury, throwing shoulder. You don't know what you're getting there.
You don't.
On offense, let alone, you know, you get to week 14. I mean,
everybody's hurt.
Throw it all up in the air and play 52-card pickup. You don't know what you're going to have there with that team. And you get them at home. And so I understand Mike's point. You know, those division games, a lot of times, you don't know which way they're going. Maybe you know where the New England game's headed just based on the level of their success, not only against the Bills, but everybody else in the division. So you say, okay, knowing you may very well have two losses there in the two New England games in the last 5 weeks, you better sure as heck win that Indianapolis game. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself out of the playoff race if you were in the hunt going into that five-week stretch at the end of the year. So I think that's a decent pick. I don't mind that one at all.
Especially your last two games are on the road, you know, because of the hockey event that's going on here. Your last two games are on the road, so you need to take that game and you need to take Miami here at home as you now have to go out to New England and then go down to Miami to finish out the season. So
803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. If you want to let us know what you feel is the most important game on the Bills' schedule with respect to 2017 playoff hopes. ESPN.com ran the analytics. They say it's week 5 at Cincinnati. Donald likes the Kansas City game in November. I think it's one of these Miami games at the end of the year for me. What do you think? 803-0550 to join us. We're back on the other side of the break. This is the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. From One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Donald Jones with you on the John Murphy Show as we close in on the end of hour one of the program here on a Monday. Good to have you with us. 803-0550, the number to call, 1-888-550-2550. As we are debating an ESPN.com piece which used a football power index analytic statistical device to determine the most important game on each NFL team's 2017 schedule, and the one they picked for the Bills was Week 5 at Cincinnati, which, I don't know about you, but left me scratching my head a little bit.
Yeah.
Donald thinks it's the Kansas City game in Week 12, and I've got one of the Miami games. Pick your poison. Probably the Week 15 game at home is more important than the one in Week 17. You got to have that one in Week 15 to probably still be treading water at the very least. What do you think? 803-0550. We do have one call that we should squeeze in before we get to the top of the hour. It's Chuck in Buffalo. Chuck, thanks for joining us. What do you have?
Yeah, I got the Jets. If we would have beat the Jets twice last year, that would have changed our season totally, I believe.
Okay. So, all right, so that's last year, but what about this year?
You lose to the Jets twice again this year, you're still in the same hole.
Well, no question about it, because I think a lot of people are saying, what, Donald? Like, you're probably going to have a tough row to hoe with the Patriots.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
and
you know,
the Dolphins, you just don't know what you're going to get. The Dolphins
are already predicted to win. You're putting yourself behind the eight ball.
Right.
You're definitely putting yourself behind the eight ball. Anytime you lose two games to the same team in your division, you put yourself behind the eight ball. Or any game in your division, you put yourself behind the eight ball. I think people are looking at the Jets like those are games that you better win.
Well, and not to mention the fact, you know, this whole Patriots factor, I mean, that reduces your margin for error in this division.
It does.
You're losing at least one. In many cases, most of these division teams lose both to the Patriots. Mm-hmm. They finish 12-4 and lose to some other first-place teams around the league on the road somewhere, go 12-4 and cruise through the division. You know, they were 5-1 in the division last year. So, you know, if you're already losing two to New England, you better sweep
the
other
two
and go 4-2. That's what Miami did, and what happened? They got in the playoffs. So, you know, that I understand his point. You know, you got to have those Jets games. But if you think about it, even if the Bills had those two Jets games, they're 3-3, still not getting it done. For me, I think your margin for error is very reduced. You got to be 4-2 in the division, I think, if you want to be ahead of one of your division opponents.
Yeah.
And knowing that New England could very well be two losses right off the bat, you got to kind of run the table. And the Bills actually did that the year before, 2015. They swept the Jets. They swept the Dolphins. But they still couldn't get their heads above water at 8-8. So it's unfortunate, but that is at least the formula division-wise, as long as Tom Brady's playing quarterback for New England. So where you go from there, as long as Brady's still playing, you better win the other four, because there's really no other way through it. And I like the fact that they are playing the Jets here at home in week one. I like that a lot. I think it's a very, very, very winnable game, because right now their offense is putting a lot of new pieces together that really is – I mean, you got some largely unproven pieces right now. Yeah. Quincy Enunwa is their number one wide receiver. Hello?
Right.
I mean, had a nice year last year as a slot guy and their third option, but holy cow, like number one?
The Jets are you get to play the Jets in the first game of the season. The Bills need to win that home opener. You have to win that game against that team that essentially looks like they're tanking their season. I mean, you have to win that game for record purposes, divisional, but even just psyche purposes, you know, for the psyche of your team and the psyche of the city, which the team doesn't really care about. But you lose that game at home, people here will be like down and out. And who knows what the team will look like at that point.
803-0550. If you want to join us, chime in on what you think is the Bills' most important game of 2017. We're going to step aside now, but coming up in our next hour, we're leading off with the former offensive coordinator of the Buffalo Bills doing some NFL initiatives with respect to coaching. Retired coach now, it's Kevin Gilbride. He'll be talking to us on the other side here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Radio Network Sports Update.
Here's a sports update from One Bills Drive. It's late in the free agency period in the NFL, but wide receiver Eric Decker has found work for the 2017 season, released by the Jets last week. Decker has been signed by the Tennessee Titans, agreeing to a one-year deal. He visited the club late last week. Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater should not be ruled out for a return to the field at some point in the 2017 season. That, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Bridgewater did throw passes during the team's recent minicamp to uncovered receivers, but still does not have full medical clearance to participate fully in practice. Bridgewater had a catastrophic left knee injury last summer, which prompted the club to swing a trade with Philadelphia for Sam Bradford. Sabres news, Zach Bogosian and Matt Molson, the headliners among the players left unprotected by the Buffalo Sabres for the upcoming expansion draft for the Las Vegas Golden Knights on Wednesday. Other notables left unprotected, veteran Brian Gionta, William Carrier, Josh Georges, Dmitry Kulikov, and Linus Olmark. Brooks Koepka won the 117th U.S. Open in Wisconsin on Sunday. It was his first major, and he did it in style as he matched Rory McIlroy's scoring record, finishing 16-under for the tournament as he cruised to a four-stroke victory. His win marks the seventh straight time that the U.S. Open produced a first-time winner. And the Bisons open a five-game series in Rochester with a twi-night doubleheader today. First pitch for game one is at 5:35 p.m. Second game is a makeup from a postponed game back on May 4th. That's your sports update from One Bills Drive. Chris Brown along with Donald Jones filling in for Murph here on a Monday. Murph will be back tomorrow here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. And we are talking about the most important game on the Bills' schedule. So we'll get into that in a little while. We'll reset the table on that. But joining us now is a former offensive coordinator for the Buffalo Bills, spent 20 years as a coach in the National Football League, won a couple of Super Bowls with the New York Giants. He is now, well, I guess semi-retired as far as coaching goes, because we're going to talk to him about something he did just this past weekend as part of an NFL initiative. It's Kevin Gilbride joining us on the line. Kevin, thanks for joining us. It's Chris and Donald with you. How you doing?
Doing great, guys. Good to be with you.
Yeah, so, you know, let's just get this recent venture squared away right off the bat. You know, the NFL is doing this NFL coaching clinic. They just had their inaugural one. Happy Father's Day weekend, by the way, scheduling that one for you. How did it go, I guess, this weekend, for just to start off?
Yeah, from what I could see, I thought it was well received by the, you know, the attendees, the coaches that were in the audience. We were, I think, blessed to have an outstanding faculty, discounting myself, of course, but there was a couple of old legends there, the offensive line with Jim McNally and Howard Mudd. They had the linebackers with Al Groh and Dave Wannstedt. North Turner, Jimmy Ray, and myself had the quarterbacks, and then the defensive line had Ted Cottrell, an old Buffalo Bill coach, and Sugar Bear Hamilton. So it was a bunch of guys that really were well prepared, and you know, had spent a lot of time, obviously, in preparing the message. And what they wanted us to address was basically the fundamentals and techniques, the basics. You know, the foundation of teaching and the individual specific techniques of the various positions that were covered. Not all the positions were addressed, just those four. And I think what the plan is next year is to move the group of coaches that were there onto four different positions, and then welcome a new group in to the original four that were, you know, that were covered yesterday or over the weekend, from Friday through Sunday. But it went well. I know all the guys who were the clinicians sat in on every lecture. So I think that's usually a pretty good indication. A bunch of guys that have been around for a long time were intrigued enough, and the quality of the presentations were good enough that everybody stayed in and listened to everybody's talk. And when you're starting at 7:30 in the morning and not finishing until about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, that's a pretty good insight as to the quality of the content.
And getting those younger upcoming coaches used to coaching hours, I guess, right? That kind of schedule, gee.
Yeah, no, I'll be honest. Those guys that were there were, you know, they're all, you know, I guess some position coaches, some quality control, some coaching assistants. So they're certainly accustomed to the hours. But I think the league felt it would be good to hear some guys that had been around for a long time. I know I coached 24 years in the NFL. I had 27 years of professional experience to go along with all my collegiate experience. And some of the guys in there had even been there further than that. So, you know, Bill Polian was the guy who kicked it off, was the he gave the opening remarks and then the closing remarks. So the Buffalo Bills were well represented.
Hey, Kevin, I've always felt like, you know, the coaches don't spend enough time in this league actually teaching, you know, like teaching the fundamentals of the positions. I understand that a lot of coaches are coaching out of the position they might have played or something like that. But a lot of the coaches in the NFL don't spend as much time teaching the basics and fundamentals of the position that, you know, they're coaching. Does the league feel the same way? And is this why they're holding clinics like this?
You know, you'd have to ask them. I certainly, that sounds like a reasonable explanation that they feel that there's a need to, you know, to improve the individual skills of the players from a technical perspective. I know that's what I talked about. I talked about the throwing motion of a quarterback and the things that would be necessary in order to throw the ball properly. So I spent 2 hours on just discussing the torque, the sequential, what I call the synchronized sequential pattern of movement that leads to the, you know, to the velocity that one has to summon at times, to the accuracy, and also taking into consideration the quickness with which football has to be delivered, and therefore how the motion is different than a pitching motion where there's no concern about how long it takes. So that's the kind of stuff that was talked about. Jim McNally got into the run blocking. He spent a couple hours on that. Howard Mudd, a couple hours on pass protection. So very definitely that was the purpose of the 3-day weekend, is to, you know, how do you get these guys better? Not through scheme and not through, outsmarting them, with a particular play or a particular blitz. You know, that will take care of itself. Guys are going to do that. But how do you help to make them grow individually so that they can execute those different schemes, those different strategies in a more efficient way? And I think that was I thought that the guys did a good job in staying plugged in into what our, you know, the directive was, which was to how do you teach fundamentals? How do you get guys to be better? And we talked about, you know, teaching strategies, methodologies of teaching. And I'll share with this. One of the things that was brought up by the coaches, because we had breakout sessions that in the evening after we were all done, and you know all the guys would say, like for example, I would say in the old days when I first started with the Houston Oilers, Warren Moon would come to me about four weeks before we started our time with organized practice time, and we would just, he and I go out and practice. He'd say, "Coach, you want to come out and throw with me a little bit?" And he basically wanted to, you know, to be instructed in and to review, you know, anything, you know, the any flaws that might have appeared with his throwing motion. And of course, he threw as well as anybody I've seen in, you know, 30 years of throwing a football. But that's the kind of interaction, one-on-one times that we could have, where we could just hone in on just the fundamentals, the foundation of doing whatever that particular skill or position was, and then we would start and review at a very slow level, slow rate, I should say, from March, April, and May before we got into June. Right. Well, those things aren't available anymore. You know, with the collective bargaining agreement, the concerns that were articulated by these younger coaches, "Coach, we don't have that kind of time. How right. can we get it done?" And it's a legitimate concern, and it's something that I think the league is aware of, and it's just a hard thing to reconcile the reduced time, particularly with these young guys that come in. Like, for example, a quarterback just getting away from the center. Well, with the way football has evolved, there's, you know, a lot of them have never been under the center before until they get to the NFL.
They're not even calling plays.
Right.
And that was discussed. In fact, we spent 1 hour of one talk, you know, just on that. How do you get up in front of a huddle and, you know, and articulate a play? And I gave an example that, you know, one of the guys I had with the Giants, Kurt Warner, would report to me every morning with the typographical errors that were in the game plan. And I mean, he was smart enough to present it. Like, "Coach, I think the secretary mistyped this." And my point was, that's how intently he scrutinized everything, and he scrutinized it working the way he did because he was practicing saying the plays, so that when he got up in front of the huddle the next day, that play would flow off his, you know, off of his tongue very smoothly, very confidently.
Yeah.
And so when the huddle broke, everybody on that offensive unit knew that the quarterback knew exactly what was going on. I mean, so we talked about stuff like that. And the only thing I said to them in conclusion, in my perspective, was, you know, when you go through these OTAs and these individual preparatory times before you get to the season, I know this, you're going to be hard-pressed to get better individually with your fundamentals during the season because time just doesn't permit it. So even though you're worried about scheme and introducing new concepts and new plays, if you didn't address the fundamentals first and foremost during the spring and during training camp, you were never going to get it done.
Yeah, it's a complete inverse relationship. The college kids are getting further and further away from what the pro game is now, and the coaches in the NFL have less and less and less time to get these players on the field, to get them the fundamental skills necessary or honed in a way where they can execute the plays that they want to. So it seems like the coaches just say, "I just got to get them ready to play the game. Let's just rep the plays and hope for the best in some cases," because there isn't that time on the field that you mentioned. It's Kevin Gilbride we're talking to, former Bills offensive coordinator on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. And, you know, I want to kind of delve into a couple of other things, Coach. I mean, everybody remembers your time here as the OC when Drew Bledsoe was the quarterback. Obviously, you won two Super Bowls with the Giants. And I think a lot of what is, you know, the soup du jour for Bills fans is trying to find some kind of way to finally vanquish the Patriots, which is easier said than done, as we have all witnessed over the last several years. as long as number 12 is playing quarterback for them and Belichick's the head coach. But I think a lot of people point to the two Giants Super Bowl victories over the Patriots as kind of the formula. Now, I know you're on the offensive side of the ball for those game plans, but can you just kind of take us through a little bit of the game planning week? And I don't know that you were privy to too much of the defensive game planning, but just what you remember from Coach Coughlin, the defensive coaches, in terms of putting all of that together and then going out and executing it.
Well, I don't know if people would remember, but in the 2007, we played them in the last regular season game, and it was actually the week after playing Buffalo up there. And we knew we had to win one of those two games to get into the tournament. And the game actually started off against Buffalo with, you know, the weather was horrific.
The goalposts went sideways on the.
Yeah, it was horrible, and snow and sleet and the whole bit. And I had just told the offensive staff, I said, you know, this is going to be one of those games. Whoever gets ahead, you better just be, because it's going to be hard to score. It's going to be hard to move the ball. And Buffalo came right down the field and scored a couple of times. I said, oh, my God, this is not going to be a good day. This is not a good omen. But we were able to come back and win the game. And so when we went to the Patriot game, both the Patriots and us said going into the game that, you know, neither one could advance, you know, our position. They were going to be number one. We were going to be wherever we were, fourth or fifth, in getting in terms of, you know, the matchups and everything else. So neither team could gain anything from that game. Neither one could position themselves any better than what we were going in. So both coaches had said that, you know, we will probably wind up removing some players as the game gets along, so on and so forth. Well, the game wound up being a battle and a half, and it was a shootout. And we were up and down the field, and they finally scored to beat us with, I think it may have been the first time they got ahead in the game, and they beat us 38-35. And it was a great game, and we were crushed, and everybody else was happy because they remained undefeated and what have you. But there were a couple of things that came out of that thing, and one was, we thought we had to do a couple of things where we had to help our defense, and we were going to do whatever we could to control the ball and maybe even be a little bit more conservative in our approach, but whatever we could do to hold on to the ball, limit their opportunities, and defensively, I knew they felt that they had to take away some of the big plays, and they would relinquish some of the stuff underneath. But it wasn't going to be the same game as it was the last regular season game. As entertaining as that was for everybody, as closely and hard fought as it was for everybody, we kind of felt we had to play it a little bit differently. But the one good thing was, I think our guys came out of that game saying, you know what? We can play with these guys. If they're the best there is in the league, you know, we just got beat here. We're as good as they are. And I think that was the positive that wound up being taken out of the game. Neither team took anybody out. Everybody played full tilt right to the end. And so that was the good thing. And when the game started in that, I don't know if people remember, but we set a record on the opening drive. Now, we only came away with 3 points, but I think we had the ball like 9 minutes and 50 seconds or whatever it was. It had set the tempo. Then they took the ball, came down and scored, and went ahead 7-3. And then thereafter, both teams kind of went up and down the field very slowly. You know, we went down the next time, and the ball bounced off Steve Smith's shoulder pad and in the end zone, or we would have had another score. They came down, we got a turnover, and it just was a totally different game than it was in the first game. But again, it was one of those hard fought games. Our defensive line really played exceptionally well and exerted a lot of pressure on them. I'm sure they felt very content because we weren't putting the ball in the end zone, and then all of a sudden, you know, in the fourth quarter, we put the ball in twice, and they only got it in once, and, you know, and we were able to come away with a win. So I thought the second time we played them, we were, quite frankly, I felt we were a better team, and we dominated the game and probably had a better chance to win by a larger margin than we did. We should have probably, we had a couple things that went against us. We had a third and one that they called a holding call on our left guard, Kevin Booth, that was you know, they had a couple players mic'd up, and you hear the umpire say to Vince Wolfert, well, you know, that was a hole, right, Vince? And Vince said, no, he said, I got away with one on that one. And that was like a 15, 20-yard gain that would have led to another score. So if you're looking for a formula, I guess it's this. They take the approach that they're not going to beat themselves, and therefore you certainly can't if you're going to win the game. And, you know, we were very confident. We played close. We weren't afraid to be in a tightly, hard-fought game. We had, in 2011, beaten them up at their place in another close game where we scored two touchdowns in the last 3 minutes of the game to beat them. So, you know, I think we have never felt our team, I'm referring to, when we went into this game, that although we had great respect for them and the way they played the game and that great quarterback they had, I think we all felt that, you know, if we played as we were capable of, you know, we could win. And, you know, we played them four times, and, we, you know, we beat them three of the four, and the one we lost was, you know, again, 38-35. That could have gone either way.
So, Coach, and everything you just said, the one thing that really sticks out to me is you need to be able to play your game, control the clock, and especially on offense, you need to be able to stay on the field and just get any points that you can get. Am I right in that?
Yeah, I think you're 100% right, because, you know, it's funny. One of the guys that spoke yesterday over the weekend was Al Groh, and, of course, he was an integral part. He was the, you know, defense coordinator at New England when Parcells was there. And, you know, he referred to their whole philosophy is limit points, limit points. So not only is that their governing or underlying philosophy defensively, you know, in the Parcellian Belichick mold, and so they make it hard to score. They'll let you move the ball, but they make it hard to put it in the end zone. And against us, what happened was in 2007, in that shootout, they struggled when they went single high covering Plexico Burress. So in the Super Bowl game, we never got too high. I mean, we never got single high. It was always too high. There was always somebody rolled up over Plexico Burress, which meant that, you know, the ability to get some of the bigger plays, because he was the receiver that was capable of giving us that, was going to be taken away from us. But it did allow us to run the ball and throw the ball underneath to other guys, Amani Toomer, Steve Smith, or what have you, in the first game. And Akeem Nix and Mario Manningham, as well as Victor Cruz in the second game. And we were able to run the ball because all they did was play us too high the whole time. Yeah. And, you know, and to be honest with you, what happened in that first game was when we got down, we threw it to Steve Smith to get the first down. That was the first time they blinked, and they went to the blitz. And that's when we hit Plexico Burress for the winning touchdown. But that's – you got to know – you know, that they're going to take away, as everybody always talks about, you know, they're going to do everything they can to deny your strengths. So you have to have already thought through then what are the things that you can do against those adjustments that you can guarantee are going to be made.
Now, Coach, when Plexico Burress scored in that first game, was that a single high?
It was a blitz zero. It was single high. It was no high. it was zero. That's why I said that was the first time they blinked all game, Dave.
Yeah.
Just so you know, the last three plays, we threw a flat curl combination that was wide open, and Eli missed it badly. And I said, "What the heck? How the heck did he miss that?" And somebody told me that our tackle was getting pushed into his face, and he couldn't follow through with the throw. So I called the exact same play again, and I just switched it over and ran it into the short side of the field. And it was a play that we always ran to the wide side of the field because we had three receivers. So it compressed the, you know, the throwing area a little bit more than I would have liked. But it allowed us to put the back on that other side. And I just told him over the, you know, the coach quarterback communication system, I said, "E, run the exact same play, run it into the short side, and tell Brandon Jacobs, don't worry about getting out. Just set in there and help the tackle block the defensive end because that's the guy that's causing you problems." So we hit Steve Smith, and we got the big gain, 14 yards, and then I called the same play again, thinking they were going to be in the same coverage, but but they went with zero. Now we had Plexico against Ellis Hobbs one-on-one in the open field, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, and I don't know how many games you're watching per week, maybe more now that, you know, you're not really coaching every Sunday anymore, but does it surprise you, or have you seen, I mean, we're talking 5, 6, 7, 8 years in the rearview mirror that these game plans worked against this Patriots team. Now, granted, you guys had a pretty darn good pass rush, too, and that always helps right. getting hits on Brady. But at the same time, it just seems like it's been hard for teams.
That second year, our defense was like 28th in the league. We weren't real good defensively. The first year we were, but the second year we weren't.
Do you feel it? Do you find it strange, though, that other teams – I mean, we've always heard about how this is such a copycat league, that teams haven't been able to replicate that formula that worked for you. And I know each team is different, and there's 25 to 30% turnover on rosters every year. But with the lack of success that other teams in this league have had, you think they'd be willing to try anything, even if it's a carbon copy and they don't have all the right pieces to completely execute what you guys did offensively and defensively, that you haven't seen more teams try it? Or are they trying it and they're just not successful?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know. I don't look at, you know, I do a lot of work. NBC Sunday night sends me their games, and I break them down beforehand, you know, what, 2 weeks ahead. And so my time is spent really in preparation for those things, getting them, you know, my analysis ready for Chris Collingsworth and Fred Gaudelli and company. But I haven't really watched the Patriot games except when they're going to be on Sunday night, and I do the prep for it beforehand. And usually I'm just looking at matchups. And, you know, I would say this, over the last period of time, New England defensively has changed substantively. They're playing a lot more, you know, in the old days, like when I was with the Bills, they played a lot of two-man, and, you know, they would blitz when you got down tight to the red zone, but otherwise it's a lot of two-man. They're playing a lot more single high, a lot more press man. I think they have a lot more confidence in their corners now. And, of course, they just added one more guy from up in your neck of the woods.
Gilmore,
so so I think they're going to even – you're seeing a lot more of that. Their coordinator there, Matty Patricia, does a terrific job. And, again, the same mold. He may not be top five in total defensive yardage, team yardage that they're surrendering, but – They're going to be near the top, and I know they were again last year in terms of the amount of points that they allow teams to score against them.
All right. Well, listen, Kevin, we appreciate you giving us some of your time here, and I'm glad that inaugural NFL coaching clinic got off to such a good start based on what you were telling us. Good luck with that, and good luck with helping Collinsworth. We know he probably needs it. You got more X's and O's for him than he probably has in his head. So we appreciate the time, and thanks for spending it with us. It was certainly enlightening for us, I know.
Yeah, it was.
Thank you. Well, I enjoyed it, guys. Thank you.
All right, that's Kevin Kilbride, former Bills offensive coordinator, 20-year coaching veteran in the NFL, and he's got 2 Super Bowl rings on his hand, both of those coming with the Giants in victories over the Patriots. I had to pick his brain a little bit because, you know, you hear about the pass-rushing success that the Giants defense had in hitting Tom Brady, and I think everybody remembers that.
Mm-hmm.
But to get some insight on what worked for them offensively, and I have heard before that you know, week 17 game was instrumental from a psyche standpoint of giving that team the confidence, because, you know, while Coach Kilbride was saying neither team could improve their playoff position, the Patriots are still trying to go for an undefeated season that year. So there was a lot on the line for them in week 17, and they won the game. Obviously, they win the most important game, which was at the end. But to hear how they were kind of processing how to play them offensively, I think, is just as interesting as, you know, what everybody seems to remember from that game, which is Brady getting hit by the Giants.
That's all everybody talks about. You know, you got to be able to get the Brady. You got to be able to get the Brady. But you got to score points as well, you know, to beat
and grind clock and control the tempo of the game to limit Brady's possessions.
Right. You know, I remember, always go back to the 2011 year when we beat them here, and our game plans against them was always we need to be able to score with them. You know, our defense was not as strong. We didn't expect our defense to stop them, so it was like we have to score points with them.
Right.
When we get third down, you got to stay on the field on third down. You can't go three and out. And that's what usually happens with them. You know, you end up going three and out, and then they get the ball and they score right away. And next thing you know, you're down 14 points or something like that trying to play catch-up against that team, and it's tough. You have to be able to either control the clock and just grind it out, or you need to be able to score points. And the biggest thing is you cannot make mistakes. You cannot make mistakes because they capitalize on all mistakes. They score points so fast. If you turn the ball over, they're going to score off of it,
right.
And you find yourself down too much.
Behind real quick.
Right.
All right, well, look, we wanted to get to Kevin and talk to him a little bit about one of the top 10 offensive players of all time in Bills history who may show up on tonight's installment of the Bills' top 10 television series airing on MSG. Episode number 2 is tonight at 9 p.m. But Donald and I are going to talk about it a little bit on the other side of the break here because there's an interesting component we want to add to the conversation. So we'll talk about that with you on the other side as we get set for episode number 2 of this 5-part series put together by the fine folks at Buffalo Bills Entertainment. It's the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Donald Jones here with you on the John Murphy Show. Murph will be back tomorrow after a nice long weekend. And at 8:03:05:50, Donald and I are kind of discussing the next installment of the Bills' Top 10 television series airing on MSG. Second one is tonight at 9 p.m. I know there's a lot of fans out there wondering when and if they can watch this, if they're outside the viewing area, because we're getting a lot of feedback on Twitter. And I do believe this will be available on BuffaloBills.com after the series has run to its completion. So you want to check back there after this series runs its course. The last episode for our MSG viewers at home are seeing that it's July 17th is the final one, top 10 individual performances of all time in Bills history. But the next installment is the top 10 offensive players in Bills history, and that airs tonight at 9 o'clock on MSG, as we said. With new episodes following each Monday with the exception of the July 4th week. And, you know, we were thinking and trying to put our heads together as to who's going to wind up on this list because neither of us were part of the internal committee that chose these 10 players. But we were kind of thinking about this. Are there any current players that you could consider either now, right now for this list, or maybe even if they ever do a new installment and have to make an amendment? And add somebody and knock somebody else out.
Right. And this is current offensive players, right?
We're talking current about offensive players that you think are worthy of the top 10 all-time list for the Bills.
I think, you know, Shady's obviously going to be in the conversation.
Right.
Because of
multiple Pro Bowls.
Yeah. You know, he's been a consistent performer every year since he came in the league. I mean, he might have had one down season or something like that. But down by his standards is – it's not that it's not down by everybody else's standards, you know. So I would think that he would be a guy who could be on an all-time, you know, list.
I would tend to agree.
Maybe a guy like Eric Wood.
Yeah, maybe. He's got a couple Pro Bowls.
You know, I guess if he can continue.
I think the litmus test there would be to see if, you know, a guy like Reuben Brown or Jim Richer,
ooh, yeah.
You know, somebody like that. Let's see if they're on the top 10 offensive players of all time list when it airs tonight. And if they are, you know, and Eric can have, you know, three or four more solid, productive, ooh, Pro Bowl caliber slash worthy type seasons, you know, maybe he can get there. But again, if we don't see Jim Richer on this list or we don't see Reuben Brown, you know.
Let me tell you, if we don't see Reuben Brown on this list, we won't hear the end of it.
Well, really? You think he's going to be that ticked?
Oh, yeah.
Reuben kind of takes a lot of stuff in stride, doesn't he?
He's takes pretty a mellow. Lot of things in
he's pretty mellow.
He's mellow, unless you know
you think
him.
He's going to be
He'll
hot?
Let you know.
You think he's going to get hot by that?
I mean, he's hot that he, first of all, he hasn't really even been a finalist to be in the Hall of Fame.
He's
made that vocal.
Okay.
He's definitely been very upfront about that here on the show one day. John and I were like, woo. All right, sorry we kind of touched that soft spot for you. And if he's not on this list, whoo.
All right.
A top 10 Bills list, he will be upset about that.
Well, I think he, as well as anybody else, realizes that a lot of times you know, the guys that play on the outside or in the backfield tend to get all of the credit, and the O-linemen don't get a whole lot of the glory. So, you know, I think there might be a grain of salt he may have to take with that if he doesn't appear on the list, because, you know, the guys that are, that should be on, that we, I think we all expect on the list, you know, some of the Hall of Famers on the offensive side of the ball, and, you know, Eric Moulds, who we had on the show last week, guy that Ruben played with for a long time, second in receiving all time on the franchise list. I mean, I think you would expect that guy to be there. So, you know, I think it's a situation where the list gets really short really fast.
It does. And that's why we talked about snubs. I don't know who's going to be on this
list. Yeah, there's
going to
be snubs.
There are going to be snubs because there's just too many good players in this franchise's history. But like you said, the guys on the outside, the wide receivers, running backs, quarterbacks, or tight ends will always get all of the love because they're the ones that are really making the plays that people remember. People don't remember the linemen. But when you talk about Ruben, a guy who went to, I don't know how many Pro Bowls, but he went to a lot of Pro Bowls, his argument would be like, man, I made all of these Pro Bowls, and I still don't get any love. Like, come on, man. I mean, I'm a lineman, so I understand I don't get the shine like everybody else, but I made so many Pro Bowls. I should get some shine.
Yeah. And, you know, he went to a Super Bowl in Chicago. Not that that really is going to have an impact on his consideration for this list, but he went somewhere else and was successful also. You know, which probably deserves at least some measure of consideration, maybe not for this list specifically, but for other things. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he's going to make the cut. I really don't. Let's see. Jim Richard played 15 years in this league. I think he went to a couple of Pro Bowls. He was a former first-round pick, just like Ruben. That's going to be tough.
It's going to be tough. We'll see.
And let's not forget the 60s guys. I mean, Billy Shaw's in the Hall of Fame. He played guard also.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in the Hall of Fame. And I think, you know, in the 10 seasons of the AFL, he was on the all-AFL team.
Yeah.
Granted, we're only talking about 8 clubs, you know, maybe a few more by the end of it. But, you know, you're talking about an 8-team league, and he's, you know, the talent is not thin in an 8-team league, and he's all-AFL for the 10-year existence, you know, of that football league. I mean, that's
not – it's going to be some snubs.
Joe DeLaMalier, there's another one. Yeah. Another guard.
Mm-hmm.
O.J. Simpson, teams, electric company, all of that. Guard alone is hard.
It's hard.
So
– it's hard. You would think, okay.
You could argue that the best offensive lineman in Bills history were all guards. You could make that argument.
Who's the best tackle in Bills history?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think there are some – there's certainly some, but
– but the best lineman that people know
– that's what I mean.
Mostly guards.
Billy Shaw, Joe D., Ruben, Jim Richer. I think Richer played center first and then moved to guard. But it's guard.
Interior line play.
If you're thinking of all-star offensive linemen in Bills history, the guard position has treated this franchise very well.
Could Richie be considered?
That's a good thought. That's
I mean, Richie's had
it's only been 2 years, but he's put together 2 Pro Bowl seasons here.
And he's helped really change the identity of that offensive line.
I would agree completely. Yeah, I think you could. I think you could throw him into the mix. And there's another guard. So, but no. I think you could throw him into the mix. I do. I will say this. I think time in Buffalo on this roster is a factor when you consider these things too. So at the end of McCoy's career, if he's here 5 years and wildly productive all 5 years, he's going to have a really, really good argument to make an amendment to this list.
That's the when you're doing lists like this, it's so hard for individual players to make one team's list because guys move around so much. It's rare that you'll have one guy in a city for an extended period of time. So if you go into Buffalo, you're drafted to Buffalo, you need to strike fast and like make plays every year for 4 or 5 years to make a list like this, because back in the day, all of these guys were playing on the same team for 10 to 12 years. You know, so it was like this guy was productive here for 10 to 12 years. Everybody, they're going to remember that. Whereas as a guy like Shady or Richie, they come in for 2, 3, 4 years, and it's like, man, they were so productive, but they only played for this amount of time because of free agency. It's just so different.
And maybe that's why somebody like an Eric Wood gets a little bit more consideration. Mm-hmm. Cordy Glenn has played well. you know, as a left tackle for this team. I think he's been dependable out there on the edge. The franchise certainly thinks a lot of him with the contract that they handed him just over a year ago. Hasn't made a Pro Bowl.
Kent Hall.
Hasn't made a Pro Bowl. But, yeah, Ken Hall. Yeah, I think you got to put him. Now, there's a non-guard. Finally, we found one. But, yeah, I mean, that's a guy that's probably going to be on this list, you would think. Because, you know, Jim Kelly has said the K-gun doesn't exist and function the way it functioned without
Ken Hall.
And I remember, you know, talking to coaches with him and the way he – because that offense moved fast. Very, very small and short terminology so they could move it faster. And on top of that, they would snap it quick too. And if he saw a front that required an adjustment, he had to come up with it fast, either with a call. So I heard this one story that Ken Hall comes up to the line and they've got a look that they have never seen before. They had a way to block it up with a check, but they had completely turned the scheme around. And so Kent recognized this, and in a matter of 2 seconds, he makes the check call, but then says, flip it. So everybody's – it's like you just put the play in a mirror.
Yeah.
Put the blocking scheme in a mirror. And just to come up with that solution like that and say, flip it.
Yeah.
And then for the other four guys to know what the heck he means by – you know what I mean? But that's how – much of a well-oiled machine that group was, because as you pointed out, you know, you've got these guys here 6, 7, 8 years playing together. And, you know, in this era of free agency, it's very hard to maintain rosters in the same way anymore.
And then, you know, when you're, it's always better when you have a team that has the same coach, you know, where guys are used to the scheme and they've seen a lot of different things. Like if Sean McDermott is here for, you know, for a long time, you have those players that are in it in this scheme with the same plays and everything. You'll get to a point where it's like, all right, I've seen this before. We can change it to this, and everybody kind of understands. But when you're turning over scheme after scheme after scheme, you never really have that type of gel where it's like he calls a play and then he says flip it. Because if you do that and you're turning over coach after coach, you'll have at least one guy that's like, what? Somebody says flip it, like what did he just say? Like,
flip it.
And totally lost, and then the quarterback is getting blasted in the backfield. You know, so I mean, you have to have the same coaching staff in one place so that he can keep his players. Everybody knows the scheme. Everybody you've seen throughout so many years, any check that you can see, and that guy can make that call, and everybody will understand what's going on. That's been the issue here for so long. Hopefully, now they will get that straightened out. But I mean, it's. I don't think people really understand how hard it is when you're on the field and a team throws something at you that you've never seen, like how quickly you have to communicate that across the board. And you have the play clock coming down. You have guys back there moving around. You have the line moving around. It's like, oh, man, I don't know what they're doing. And then the quarterback or whoever has to call out a play, everybody has to get that signal. That goes back to what Coach Gilbride was talking about. The coaches have to spend so much time in scheme and so much time in checks, and you check to this if they go this, that they don't have a lot of time to really work on fundamentals with these players.
803-0550, 1-888-550-2550 if you want to join us. If you have a nominee for a current Bills player on the roster that you think is deserving of being on the Buffalo Bills top 10 offensive players of all time, which airs tonight on MSG at 9 o'clock, let us know. We'll see if a current player shows up on the list, but it's a deep pool of candidates and a lot of history, 58 years in all. So we'll see who shows up tonight on that list at 9 p.m. Donald and I back on the other side. It's the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Donald Jones here with you on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. Closing in on the second hour of the program. Reminder, we'll have Lorenzo Alexander on the line with us in the third hour. That's coming up after the break.
The lowdown.
But, you know, we were throwing around any current players that we should consider for the second episode tonight of the Top 10 television series for the Bills. Top 10 offensive players of all time is the installment tonight. on MSG at 9 p.m. And we've knocked around a couple of names. We'll see what you guys think at 803-0550. We'll lead off with Curtis in Dansville. Curtis, who do you have for a nominee?
Hey, Donald.
How you doing?
Chris, I was thinking, you know, McCoy's probably, you know, one of the most talented backs we've had, if not just talented any back in Buffalo. I know people might be up in arms about that, but I think a few years only being in Buffalo is what holds him back from being on that list, though.
Do you think there's anybody else on the list, you know, that you could consider now, or is just the talent pool too deep from 58 years of Bills history?
For our history, the talent pool is way too deep. I mean, Cordy's a good tackle. McCoy, you know, great back. But in terms of anybody on the roster now, I don't see it happening.
All right, Curtis, we appreciate the call. I mean, I don't know if you feel differently. You were trying to throw out some. You were trying to throw a bone to the offensive line.
We were.
You were. Well, you were leading that charge. I mean, I was happy to jump in there with you, but I agree. It's really tough.
It is hard. I mean, you really have some talent and guys that are produced in this league. You have Hall of Famers, you know, and it's like, could you see anybody on the team right now that right now at this point in their career, Hall of Famer?
I mean. McCoy's probably the only one that may get there. Yeah.
Right, that may get there. So he needs to have a couple more productive seasons like he's had to have strong consideration of being in the Hall of Fame. So when you talk about a franchise with so many Hall of Famers,
right,
it's hard for these guys to get in that list.
You've got six offensive players in – six Hall of Famers who are offensive players in team history. And the guy I think who was here the shortest was James Lofton. For the shortest period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Billy Shaw, Bruce, Andre Thurman. Or no, not Bruce. Andre Thurman and Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And DeLamelier. So those are your six. Three are guards.
Right.
Are we going to see three guards on this list?
We might. I mean, if you have Hall of Famers, they can't get snubbed, right?
I don't know.
You can't snub Hall of Famers.
So you want to? You think it's a lock? All six Hall of Famers are going to be on the top 10 list?
I would think so. Offensive,
okay. Even Lofton.
That might be.
Maybe time on the roster could hurt him.
Yeah,
because he was
hurt.
Only what was he here for? 4 years.
That could hurt.
89 to 93, 92, 93.
Yeah, I mean, you think about him, but you think about Andre, you think about Molds and other offensive skill position guys like Jim and Thurman and even a guy like OJ who probably should be on the list.
Yeah, he'll be on the list. Oh, my gosh.
Right, you know. So it's like Kenny Lofton, he would be right on the fringe of
James Lofton.
I mean, James Lofton. Did I say Kenny Lofton?
Yeah, you're going center fielders here.
Thinking baseball. Yeah, James Lofton would be right on the fringe of if he should be in this thing or not.
I don't – man. This is tougher than I thought.
Yeah, because there's a lot of talented players.
Again, I wasn't on that committee, and now I see you. I mean, you're
glad you weren't on that committee.
You could get to splitting hairs really fast. I am telling
you.
You're
like, what? You're going to leave this guy off the list?
I'm glad I'm publicly announcing I was not on that internal committee. I don't need any Twitter blowback tonight when people are upset that so-and-so isn't on the list, because it's coming.
It is going to come.
They're going to find the people.
It might come from those people themselves that didn't make the list.
Oh, my gosh. You can give me a coughing fit here in a second. Yeah, I can't see. How do you leave a Hall of Famer? I can't.
How do you leave a Hall of Famer?
That's tough.
That's tough.
So with those six, you got to think those six are taken. Then you've got Molds. Who? We forgot OJ. OJ's in the Hall of Fame too.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's maybe it's seven.
Seven Hall of Famers.
I don't know. I got to count again.
I believe it was seven.
Billy Shaw.
I feel like Mike said it was seven.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, man, 7 of the 10 spots, you're just locking it up.
Just locking it up. You can't leave Hall of Famers off the list, right?
803-0550, but on the other side, we've got Lorenzo Alexander. Okay, he's going to be joining us on the line. We'll be talking with him. He is a media mogul.
He is.
So we're going to tap into his expertise, get his thoughts on how spring practices went, where he feels this team is at, maybe in comparison to the roster he joined under Rex Ryan. And what he feels the prospects are. We'll also talk to him about some NFLPA stuff, with some players talking about some things going on with respect to rookie deals, cap floor, all of that. He's an NFLPA rep, so we'll get his take on that. It's the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Radio Network Sports Update.
Your sports update from One Bills Drive. Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater should not be ruled out for a return to the field at some point in the 2017 season. That, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Bridgewater did throw passes during the team's recent minicamp to uncovered receivers, but still does not have full medical clearance to participate in practice. Bridgewater had a catastrophic left knee injury last summer, which prompted the club to swing a trade with Philadelphia for Sam Bradford. It's late in the free agency period, but wide receiver Eric Decker has found work for the 2017 season, released by the Jets last week. Decker has been signed by the Tennessee Titans, agreeing to a one-year deal. He visited the club late last week. Some Sabres news, Zach Bogosian and Matt Molson, the headliners among the players left unprotected by the Buffalo Sabres for the upcoming expansion draft for the Las Vegas Golden Knights on Wednesday. Other notables left unprotected, veteran Brian Gianta, William Carrier, Josh Georges, Dmitry Kulikov, and Linus Olmark. Brooks Koepka won the 117th U.S. Open in Wisconsin on Sunday. It was his first major, and he did it in style as he matched Rory McIlroy's scoring record, finishing a total of 16 under for the tournament as he cruised to a four-stroke victory. His win marks the seventh straight time that the U.S. Open produced a first-time winner. And the Bisons open a five-game series in Rochester with a twilight doubleheader tonight. First pitch for Game 1 is at 5:35. That second game, a makeup from a postponed game back on May 4th. And that's your sports update from One Bills Drive. Chris Brown along with Donald Jones here on the John Murphy Show, filling in for Murph today. He will be back on the air with Donald tomorrow. And joining us via Skype here this hour is Bills linebacker Lorenzo Alexander, the media mogul, as we now call him. This guy's all over the place. Lorenzo, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate you giving some time to us here in the afternoon. Like, you just left this building on Thursday, and we're already, right, you know, bugging you here to give us some insights.
Lorenzo, I'm going to just tell you, I was the one that said, you know what, reach out to Lorenzo because he's probably not doing anything.
Yeah, I'm sure it was you, Donald.
No, well, actually, you know, I got a busy day. I just finished working out and had my son with me, took him with treatment. So we've been ripping and running all day. But, you know, I can always fit you guys in. Y'all like family over there.
We appreciate that. Now you're getting all mushy.
About
Donald.
To start,
okay?
Crying and everything.
Well, you know, Donald is always giving me a hard time, so you know, just get used to it. You know, we'll go back and forth like we always do when I'm in studio. Yeah.
Now, I didn't get a chance to talk to you at the close of minicamp, but a couple of your veteran teammates, Eric Wood among them, felt right that this minicamp and spring practices in general were the most intense that he has seen in his time here in Buffalo. Now, I think when you have a first-year head coach and a new coaching staff right coming in, I think you always expect it to ramp up a little bit, guys trying to prove themselves to the new coaching staff. But do you feel like it even went beyond that because of the way Coach McDermott has tried to put this thing into motion with respect to his vision plan for this team?
Right. Most definitely. I've been in this league for 13 years, and I think he might be my fourth new head coach that I've had. And then obviously everybody's out there vying for a job, got rookies coming in, making sure that they belong. You got coaches coming in, making sure that they establish the culture that Coach McDermott is trying to create for us. And with all that, obviously, it's going to be a higher tempo out there, more competitive. But I think the key was, like you said, and Eric Wood, I think, alluded to it as well, is that it's sustained throughout the entire offseason program. Oftentimes, you have a new guy come in, and it only lasts, you know, maybe for the first or second week. But the energy that Coach McDermott really brings to our team and to practices each and every day really percolated throughout the whole offseason schedule. Now, the key is to kind of take that over these next 6 weeks and continue that on your own at home, and then bring that same type of energy back as us players when training camp starts. Because right now it's easy to kind of keep that energy. Everybody's feeling good. It's a fresh start. But we haven't really had any live bullets, any adversity yet. So during training camp, you know, when it's hot, it gets muggy out there, you know, guys are tired. Some guys maybe get nicked up because now we're hitting. Can you maintain that same type of energy, competitive atmosphere while we're out there? And obviously we're going to be playing games as well then at that time. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's the true testament to see where this team is going to be going this year. And if we can figure out a way to win one or two more games and find ourselves in the playoffs.
Lorenzo, I've always felt like this month or this time off, this 6 weeks, 5 or 6 weeks that you guys get off is like one of the most crucial months and a franchise. And going into the season, if the guys can take the momentum you just had from mini camps and OTAs and take that into your offseason or this month of training so that you're ready right. for training camp. Once you get to training camp, you don't have any steps back. I've always felt like exactly. this is like one of the most important times going into the season. Is that something that you guys, as the veterans on the team, talk to the younger guys about?
Oh, most definitely. You know, that was kind of throughout the whole offseason program, but even that last week, really that last day, just making sure that we communicate it. When guys come back, we need the best version of yourself. And for everybody, that's going to look a little bit differently. But at the end of the day, we're out here to win games, get to the playoffs, and win championships. So whatever it takes you to be a part of that, and your best way, you know, whether that's losing a little bit of weight, understanding the playbook a little bit better, being more consistent football player from down to down and day to day. Whatever that looks like for you, just making sure that you correct all that during the 6 weeks, improve on it. So when we get back, you're not playing catch up. You're not out of shape. You haven't looked at the playbook for a month, so now you may be mentally slow out there. So whatever that specific issue that you need to work on or improve on, we definitely made sure everybody knows from top to bottom. I'm the same way. Me and Kyle are no different than Tre'Davious White. We're all in this together because your time is always limited. You never know when your last season is. So we're going to all make sure that we're on the same page and hitting the ground running when we hit training camp in July.
Yeah, I mean, I know Coach McDermott addressed the media on that subject too, because, you know, when your players aren't around, they're out, you know, on their own,
yeah.
you know, subject to their own devices, their own decisions.
Right.
You know, he says, I'm praying for him. I'm praying for him. I'm hoping everything's okay the next 5 or 6 weeks. It's a right. genuine concern.
Yeah.
Because coaches love control. And when the players exactly. aren't here, they don't have that control.
Right.
And that's where your veteran leadership comes in. I think he did a great job of trying to build relationships within the guys, you know, having different guys throughout the year share their stories, you know, strategically placing guys throughout the locker room with young guys. I know I have a couple of young guys next to me that don't necessarily play my position, you know, whether they're a receiver or a DB, but building those relationships. So in the offseason, he's praying, but I'm calling guys. You know, checking in. How you doing? How's the family? You been working out? You know, you need anything? How can I help you? And I think each guy has, you know, especially the leaders have kind of been charged with reaching out to, you know, everybody knows the one or two guys that you may have a good relationship with that may need a little extra push or encouragement during the offseason. So I know I made sure to challenge guys, just pick up the phone and make that connection. So guys aren't just out there on their own that whole time. You still, you know, with, you know, technology these days, whether we're calling or Skyping like we're doing right now, you can still have that relationship and making sure guys are being accountable to themselves and as well as the team.
I've got a two-part question for you because you brought something up that sparked my memory. But the locker room is – part one is locker room is a complete jumbled jigsaw puzzle now. You know, typically yeah. in a lot of locker rooms, it kind of – it loosely goes by position group. In terms of, you know, we line up four or five linebackers over here and the kickers and punters are over here and the quarterbacks and wide receivers. There's usually an area, a general area at least, for certain position groups. Coach McDermott has turned that on its ear. He's flipped it all around. I mean, there's still a couple of guys in familiar places, but I walked in there the other day. I got to reboot my memory because I don't know where everybody is anymore.
Yeah.
But maybe speak to maybe why Coach McDermott did that, you think. Maybe he's communicated it to you, being one of the veteran players, why he might have done that. And secondly, you talked to me last year about some players that on every roster in the NFL drift into the gray. And you right. veteran players have to pull them out of there and get them on the right side of the fence. So first address the locker room jumble. And then yep. where you feel this roster is right now, I know you still don't know everybody maybe on this roster like you want to. How many right. might be drifting into the gray sometimes, and is it less than last year?
Well, it's definitely strategically the way our locker room has been set up. And I think, you know, he's placed guys around veteran leadership, guys that he knows has the ability to become leaders themselves. So, you know, guys like Kyle Williams, Tyrod, myself, and other guys in that locker room who have been identified, Jordan Poyer, Micah Hyde, you know, especially on the defense, to help cultivate that leadership attribute that he sees in maybe a first or second year player. And then also some of those guys that we mentioned that may drift in the gray, to pull them along so they can see not just only on the practice field, but how I get ready for practice, how Kyle gets ready, what is he doing at his locker? Is he in his playbook? What does his day look like? Or just to have a simple conversation and get to know what does he do in the offseason. Sometimes when you're not, next to a guy as far as the locker, you really don't get to know that intimate relationship as far as kids, wives, family, all that stuff that really brings guys together. So when you're out there, you're playing that much harder because you know them a lot better. And as far as guys being in the gray, I think Coach McDermott and the whole front office have really done a great job of identifying high character guys, but they have the ability to play. So this year, the guys that may drift, you can't drift because there's so many guys pulling in one direction. We don't have guys that can kind of click up or kind of woe is me together and kind of lag behind. I think we've done a great job of just bringing in some hardworking guys, guys that know how to win, have won, and have high character, and are ready to go out there and play ball. And when you see guys like that starting for a team, playing well, producing, you're forced to keep up. You're forced to mold to the culture that we're trying to create. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things, because oftentimes, talent is king in his league, and you're sometimes willing to take a less character guy for the talent that he brings. But I think we've done a great job. Everybody I look across as far as we brought in it, from free agency are high character, great dudes, but have talent, can play. They ball out on Sundays, and I've played against them and really respect that they're on our team now.
Lorenzo, you've been in this league really since like the AFL days, like way back in the
Wow.
Yes. All right, I'll just mess with you. You know, man, I had to throw that out there.
Man. I mean, I'm sorry. We got to go out to the backyard and handle this old school? I mean, what's up, man?
Oh, man. No, but
no,
seriously.
Man, you hit me from a distance.
That's how I do it. I do it through Skype.
You talk to me on Skype, but when I'm sitting next to you, it's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, all right. But look, I got a serious question for you. you have been in the league, though, what, 13? This is your 13th year in this league. You've gone through a lot of different coaches. How different are the things that Coach McDermott is doing now with this team in terms of the locker room, in terms of how practices run? How different is what he's doing from any of the coaches you've been under?
The coaches I've been around who've been successful, I don't really think it's all that much different. It's all about, when I was with Bruce Arians, he didn't really have a lot of rules. It was all about trust, loyalty, respect. I mean, with Coach McDermott, we don't have a lot of rules. It's all about love, which is the same thing, trust, loyalty, and respect. Mm-hmm. And I think when you start there, you naturally have those other attributes that I mentioned. You don't have to have a lot of rules because you're trusting everybody, going to be loyal, and you're going to be respectful. As far as building relationships, I was around a guy, Joe Gibbs, was huge on that. You know, a man of faith, building relationships, that continuity, mind, body, and soul all coming together. So from all the guys that I've been around that have had success in this league, he has a little bit of each person. And obviously he's putting into his own way, bringing his own style to it. So I'm very excited about what this team is going to be able to do. I think it fits to this new age of player two that's coming to the league that needs a little bit more structure and vision kind of communicated to them so they're not left in the wind versus a guy like myself. It doesn't matter who's the head coach. So I think and those are the guys that you depend on, your rookies, your second and third year players, because they haven't quite found out how to be a professional. And the way he's structuring everything is going to force them and obviously cultivate them into the professional they need to be if they want to have any type of longevity in this league. So I'm seeing a lot of great things from him. I know he's going to continue to keep it up because he has energy for days. So I'm just looking forward to it, and to be one of his soldiers out there, warriors to kind of help replicate and spread that culture. I'm there for him, and I just can't wait till we get into the heat of the battle, because that's really where you start seeing greatness be produced with all this planting and of soil we're doing right now. So when we hit the season, all the good labors that we've put in come to fruition, and then we can be able to step up and play well when the game is for real.
Talking to Bills linebacker Lorenzo Alexander, who's joining us on Skype here on the John Murphy Show. And Lorenzo, I know, you're an NFL player rep, and, there's been some stuff percolating around the league, and during a dead time, it's getting more attention. Ryan Shazier, the linebacker from Pittsburgh, was one who was commenting on rookie deals for players. He's obviously been pretty successful early in his career. Aaron Donald's probably another example. Odell Beckham Jr., another example. And these guys feel a little restricted by the current way the CBA reads. And I'll just read you Ryan's quote. I just want to kind of get your feel on it, because he says, quote, at the end of the day, if you're playing at that level, you should be able to get that opportunity to redo your rookie contract whenever you want to. And he basically says, at the end of the day, it's between you and the team. If the team wants to do it, it's great. If you play at that level, you should be able to re-up whenever. We all know the fifth-year option that exists for those top 15 picks. It kind of holds their salary in line, even though they are getting paid significantly more than maybe those first 4 years. But what do you think about wiggle room for rookie deals?
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, obviously, it's something that, you know, guys that are in a situation want change, and it makes complete sense. I mean, I've been in a deal myself, you know, sign a 3-year deal and you outplay it, and I didn't have any restrictions on mine, and the team still didn't want to do it. So, you know, even if we don't have that restriction in there, I'm always for less regulation anyway. And then it kind of puts it on the team, because right now the teams are hiding kind of behind that clause as far as re-upping guys. Well, we can't do nothing anyway. Where really they probably wouldn't, you know, extend you even if they could in most cases. You know, you look at teams, they always, you know, planning for salary cap, who they're going to sign in the offseason. So if you got cheap labor and you signed a 4-year deal as an owner or as a GM, why am I going to re-up you in your third year when you still have 2 more years to play? Right. So I understand the sentiment, but I just don't think teams would honor it. You know, it's one thing to be, you know, have great relationships from coach to player, but when it goes to the business side, a lot of that stuff gets, you know, murky, and it becomes all about business. And from a GM's perspective, if I have a young, talented guy that's balled out, all pro in his second year, and I still got 2 more years before I have to worry about signing him or extending him, and, you know, in a obviously a salary cap league, why would I do that? You know, just from a business standpoint, outside of making him happy. So it sounds good, but I don't necessarily know if we would get any different result or have guys sign earlier. It would actually put more pressure on the teams, because right now they hide behind that clause.
Not to mention the fact that you'd tick off 31 other teams for setting that precedent.
Exactly.
Right.
You just messed everything up. Hey, Lorenzo, how often do the younger guys on the team, and I don't know if the younger guys on this team even know that you're so involved with the NFLPA, but how much – or how often do they come and speak to you about different things? Like, hey, Lorenzo, is this okay? Like, just ask you different questions about things.
Yeah, well, we have several leaders on our team that have been a part of the union. I'm actually an executive committee member on our team. It's Tyrod, Eric Wood. Also, Patrick DeMarco has been a rep. And I think Micah Hyde as well. And we've sat down and presented to the team as far as things that are going on as far as NFL and NFLPA business. So guys come to me when they have questions, you know, whether it's about something that's going on at practice, you know, whether it's insurance, whether it's some type of clause in their contract. And I'm just kind of a liaison, because I have an understanding of everything, but I don't have a great grasp. So I'm kind of a middleman between the PA and the players. And I oftentimes send them over, direct them to the PA. We have a great player advocate in Zamir, and he does a great job as far as getting guys what they need. But guys come to me often, and I try to direct them as best as I can, or educate them on what I've learned throughout my years.
And I don't want to give away any secrets with regard to scheme or anything, but we're trying to get a handle on your role in this defense. And you know, we see you moving around a good deal, you know, based on packages and things like that. Would it be to put a general label on maybe your role this year, should we call you a jack of all trades type, just in terms of the different roles you may have in this scheme?
That's been my whole career. So I'm a, you know, I just tell them to put athlete next to my name. Don't put linebacker, D lineman, just put ATH, because I'll be everywhere, you know, whether it's outside rushing on the edge, playing off the ball linebacker, on the ball linebacker, line up at D tackle, all these things that I did last year. I think Coach McDermott came in, and also Leslie Frazier watched the film and saw that I have ability to move around. You know, oftentimes people say, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. But I was pretty effective, you know, being able to do that as well as play special teams. So I look forward to helping out the team in various ways, in different packages. And I think you see that across our defensive personnel in general. I mean, a lot of guys can play nickel or corner, can play safety or come down and play corner. play defensive tackle or defensive end. We just have a lot of guys that they brought in to be versatile, and it just helps you as a defensive coordinator to call different packages, give different looks, but play maybe some of the same calls just because you have a lot of guys can do a lot of different things. And it looks different, but we're playing something different, or it looks the same and it's something different. So it's just a great way to play great defense because you never know what we're in.
Before letting Donald take his final parting shot, as he usually likes to do, like on our Bills today, what we did find, and I don't know how much you're into the advanced analytics, Lorenzo, but you know, Pro Football Focus has theirs, and you take it with a grain of salt sometimes. But yeah, they did an advanced metric that measured guys who were most effective in the league last year in terms of turning pressures into sacks, and you were third in the league in that category last year. Obviously, you know, you had 12 and a half sacks on the season.
Right.
I don't know if I fully grasp what that stat measures, but I'm guessing you're not just getting the pressure, you're finishing the play. So
right, that's what it is. Like, you know, taking advantage of the opportunity, because a lot of times you can get pressure in this league, and it's hard to get quarterbacks down. You know, especially if you're playing against like a Cam Newton or Ben Roethlisberger. So I think it's just converting that pressure into a sack, which is fine and dandy. But like you said, the metric system, because some stuff I'm probably at the bottom of the league, you know, in. So I just kind of take it with a grain of salt. It's something great for the fans to kind of grasp and keep them engaged into the game. But as players, you know who's out there balling or not, and right, you really don't need the analytic part of the game to see that on film.
You got any challenges you want to throw out?
No, no challenges. I really do have a question, though. I have a question for you.
Okay.
As a veteran in this league, a guy who's going into his 13th season, a guy who is a father, husband, a true family man, and you keep those core values, what do you think about when you hear a guy like Michael Bennett say what he said in terms of why he missed OTAs?
It makes great sense. And, you know, I'll say everybody's situation is different and everybody's mindset. I mean, that's something that I struggle with. You know, at this part of my career, do I need OTAs to train and be ready? No. But this particularly, I need to learn the defense, and I offer a great leadership, I think, value to the team as well. But Michael Bennett, his situation in Seattle may be completely different. I do understand what he's saying, because, you know, four days of the week, I'm up in Buffalo and I'm missing taking kids to school, picking them up, missing some football practices. You know, I was a coach this year as well, and I couldn't attend everything that I wanted to. Luckily, I was able to do my daddy-daughter dance with my daughter. You know, that stuff was on the weekend, but it's hard. It's very challenging, and, you know, he has a strong wife behind him as well. And I, you know, without them, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. And so I have respect for however you want to handle your offseason. But, you know, guys are on different spectrums, treated differently. And then obviously, if you're in that city, some guys live in the city, so it makes it really easy. When I played with Washington Redskins, I lived in Virginia year-round, so it was really easy just to go over to work and still do my family duty. So everybody's situation is different. I get where he's coming from, and I really respect it. I mean, Michael Bennett is so articulate and puts things in great perspective, and getting to know him kind of this offseason a little bit, I really, really respect everything that he does, you know, socially, football-wise, and in the community.
Well, knowing this is the time where you get the most family time, we appreciate you giving us 20 minutes of your time here today, Lorenzo. It was always a pleasure having you on the show, and we'll leave you alone for 6 weeks.
I bet.
We can't promise that. We can't promise that.
Hey, I'm not going to be on this. I'm not on the rest of the week, so I'm good. I'm not going to bother him for 6 weeks. I don't know about you guys. You guys figure that out on your own. Thanks, Lorenzo. As always, we appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, that's Lorenzo Alexander, Bills linebacker, on Skype, helping us out here on the John Murphy Show, lending some insight to a varied array of topics because, you know, he can always kind of tap into those different things.
He can.
You know, from league issues to things, you know, that you brought up with the Michael Bennett thing. That was a good thing to bring up, you know, knowing he's a dad also, mm-hmm. and he values the work-life balance, you know, that sometimes people lose sight of. Even Coach McDermott said, when I was a young coach, you know, I wasn't holding up my end of the bargain at home. I had to reassess the priorities and establish a better work-life balance. I think it's a challenge for players sometimes, young dads. I mean, we're talking 20-something-year-old guys who've got kids at home, you know, and a significant other or a wife, and you got to balance things.
A guy like Kadavious, you know,
coming in as a newborn.
A rookie, has a newborn the same weekend that he was drafted in, and then, you know, he has to learn the playbook. He, you know, when you're a first-round pick, you have pressure on you just because people expect you to perform, so you want to put in all of the work that you have to put in so that you can perform once the season comes around. But at the same time, you have a child back home. And
you're thinking about what you're missing.
Right, exactly. It's not an easy thing to deal with.
803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. We're going to get back into some of the discussion we had earlier. Most important game on the Bills' schedule. And we may even throw a little top 10 in there, too, with the second installment of the top 10 Bills offensive players of all time, set to air tonight on MSG at 9 o'clock. Donald and I back on the other side. This is the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. From One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Donald Jones here on the John Murphy Show. Murph will be back tomorrow as he's taking a long weekend. And Donald kind of came up with an interesting thought with the NBA draft coming up real quick. I know you're an NBA fan.
Yeah, NHL is coming up too, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a busy June for drafting, at least for the NBA and the NHL. Mm-hmm. They also have the expansion draft on Wednesday too. But it was an interesting thing that you brought up, just talking about how in basketball, sometimes you have one draft class and boom, you know, you're off and running. Now, the thing about the NBA draft, though, is it's only two rounds.
Right.
And a lot of times they trade away second round picks like it's a piece of bazooka gum. It's just like they don't.
Piece of bazooka gum.
They just give it away. The Knicks are famous for that. Mm-hmm. But. You want to know if you can do that in the NFL? Is it possible to do that with one draft class? Can I mean, I guess you go back to the Steelers 74 draft class when they got like Mean Joe Green, Jack Lambert, and all of those guys in one draft.
In one draft.
That was ridiculous. And yes, you turned them into a four-time Super Bowl winner with the core of that draft class.
I think it's harder, obviously, in the NFL just because the team is so big. You only get a certain amount of draft picks. To have one draft class just totally change everything, change the fortune of a franchise. I'm sure people would argue if you draft the right quarterback, that will change everything for a franchise. I know in the NBA, you know, you look at Cleveland, for a long time they were terrible until they drafted LeBron James, and then they were in the finals and things like that, and he was just one player.
Right.
You know, so it's just
so
there's
only
different.
Five players on the floor, though.
Right. You know, so it's so different in the NBA just because the rosters, and I'm sure hockey, too, because the rosters are so much smaller for you to be able to draft one or two guys, and they totally just change the entire franchise. The NFL is just a lot harder to do.
And even if you think about quarterbacks that did get drafted and have had enough time in the league to say to fit that argument that some people might say, you draft the right quarterback, you're off and going. Andrew Luck has made the playoffs once, I think. And that's not necessarily his fault. I mean, the GM that drafted him already got fired. So you look at that and you say, well, maybe it isn't. And I think we always hear the common moniker that's given to football. It's the ultimate team sport because you need everybody working in concert maybe in that sport more than any other, and there's 11 guys on the field. So with that in mind, I don't know that you can equate the two. I don't think you can do
it's
it.
Yeah.
And I suppose that, you know, if you've built the thing the right way, maybe there's that tipping point draft class that helps the team reach critical mass, and now we are championship caliber, and then people who only remember – what have you done for me lately, might point to the draft class and say, this is the draft class that did it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it might very well be three of the previous four draft classes in concert on the field has pushed them to that level.
Right.
I think that's the more likely thing or the more likely scenario. I mean, you want to flip it over to hockey, you can think about the Edmonton Oilers. They've had a lot of top five picks over the last 6 to 8 years. And they get to draft Connor McDavid, number one, a couple of years ago. And now you're finally seeing them as a playoff team and probably what will be a perennial playoff team for the future. But everybody is looking at Connor McDavid. Well, they also have guys, you know, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Taylor Hall, you know, these top picks that they've been rolling through. Now it's reached critical mass where all of that talent pooled together has pushed them forward. I don't know, man. I guess NBA would probably be the only one that you can really do that. And that's hard, too, because who's picking at the top of the draft? The worst teams in the league, usually.
But then you look at this year, which I didn't understand. Boston was, like, the number one team in the East in terms of record, and they still had the number one pick. Now, they just traded it away, but it was like, how'd that even happen? The NFL is just so different because you look, there are certain teams in the NFL that are always drafting in the top 10. So it's like, all right, you draft in the top 10, you know, seven of the last 10 years, and you still don't have a good team, but it's usually because the coaching staffs are turning over. And
there's so much
churn from top to bottom in terms of your roster from front office to coaching staff that now you have players that don't even get a chance at developing into something because there's a new coaching staff that doesn't like this guy or he brings in a new scheme. This guy doesn't fit in that scheme, you know. So
we've seen that here.
Right, exactly. So it's so hard in the NFL for one draft class to change things unless, like you said, you've built this thing the right way and you have this one good draft that takes it over the top.
Yeah, and that means doing everything right, you know, the previous two, three, four years
even
leading up to that.
And your team might be 8-8 type of thing,
yeah,
and you have one draft class that –
because and some people get blinded by some of these teams that go worst to first, but a lot of times those teams that go worst to first are often the product of circumstance more than the talent that they might have on their roster. And what I mean by that is you may have a key player with a catastrophic season-ending injury. Now you don't have a guy to use every week in matchups, and now you're a 7-9 team.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get that guy back the next year. Maybe you have a good draft class on top of that. One or two of those guys are starting for you. And now, bang, you're a playoff team
because
you just made a 4-win difference in your club by virtue of the fact that you got this guy back and you've got these guys that can win matchups or these guys that can make plays on defense.
Yeah.
And it all fits together the right way. I guess the Seahawks would be a good example of that, just the way they built that thing. With a couple of those drafts that they had back-to-back. I mean, Russell Wilson wasn't even supposed to be the starting quarterback. Matt Flynn was. And then he comes in and outperforms him and steps into a role that I don't think anybody anticipated he'd be stepping into as a rookie, let alone even a second-year player.
I would say Dallas could be a
They've
team
drafted
too,
well.
They drafted for years linemen in the first round.
Yep.
Another lineman in the first round. And I remember Cowboys fans that I know personally, like, man, what are we doing? And then the one year they draft the right quarterback, even though he went in the fourth round, third or fourth round, he drafted Ezekiel Elliott in the first round, and it took them over the top, you know, and they wanted to, now they still didn't make it all the way, but at least you had a team that was like, oh, this is a good team last year. So we'll see if they can carry that over to this year. But, yeah, I think you have to kind of build it up the right way for some years, and then that one draft class can.
See, and what makes that interesting is the Giants, which typically subscribe to the draft building model, have kind of flipped the script the last 3 years. They've invested heavily in free agency when they, I mean, since the time I was a little kid.
They never invested in free agency.
Never did that. They may get a spare part kind of guy or you know, a late in the free agency period signing just to fill a hole as a stopgap for a year, maybe two. But they're a team, much like Pittsburgh, that's known to be extremely patient with their draft choices. If a guy looks like a bust in year two, they'll stick with that kid and keep working with him. Give him a third year. Give him a fourth year. And very often, they might be a Johnny-come-lately, but they'll finally get it. And then they'll be okay because they've got a guy in that spot, and he's been there for 4 years, and then he's ready to play. So they'll do extensive grooming with their draft picks to make sure they pan out and work for them when a lot of other teams will pull the ripcord and send the guy on his way to find a job somewhere else in the league. To see them make that shift is a real change in philosophy for them and one that you don't anticipate from a traditional historic franchise like the Giants.
Now, you know, Mike Coughlin was there for how many years?
Tom Coughlin?
I mean, yeah. I get
You're switching
confused.
First names on me today.
I know
you got
I
Kenny
am.
Lofton earlier. You're throwing me for a loop. I got to try to catch up with you, man. I can't do it.
Hey, but you're on top of it, though. You're on top
well, yeah,
of
it.
But
takes
I can
me
see you
second,
look, though. You're looking like.
I'm like, who the heck is he talking about? Now? Who's Mike Coughlin? Tom Coughlin.
Yeah,
okay.
Tom Coughlin was there for a good amount of time. Won two Super Bowls there, but it really goes because at the front office and Jerry Reese. I mean, he's been there for some time, so it makes you wonder: is that something that he's always wanted to do, Jerry Reese? Like maybe
and now
we
he's
should
been
be
on the job long enough,
right?
Where you can put it into motion.
And Tom Coughlin's not there. Maybe Tom Coughlin
that probably
had
helps
more,
too.
Right. Tom Coughlin's like, no, we want to draft and keep it this way. And now that he's gone, Jerry Reese at the top of things is saying, nah, we should get some big name free agents in here.
Right. And then you have a team like the Raiders who for a while there, they were trying to pluck guys from free agency to try to augment their roster after some failed draft classes. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this before. Teams that don't draft well are often forced to overpay and go into free agency to fill holes that weren't effectively filled by the players they drafted. Mm-hmm. And Oakland was in that boat for a little while, but then they have a couple of good draft classes. Yep. Amari Cooper, Derek Carr, you know, players like this, even Menelik Watson, the offensive lineman, has panned out for them. And so, you know, you have a team ready to take that next step. Now, granted, they faded towards the end of last year and were a disappointment in the playoffs after a really strong regular season. Mm-hmm. But that's a team that's, you know, on the rise, I think, in the eyes of many people. I'll put myself in that boat, which is why that's probably one of the games I'm looking forward to the most on the Bills schedule this year. They've got to come here after that game last year.
I just look forward to Marshawn coming back to Buffalo.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really – that wasn't the first thing that comes to mind when I'm thinking Oakland now, but it is. It is unquestionably going to be something.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that should be an interesting reception.
I'm telling you, it'll be a very interesting reception for Marshawn Lynch.
All right, we got to take a quick break, but we'll be back to find out what we learned on today's show. Donald and I to close things up and put a bow on this one here on a Monday. It's the John Murphy Show. Presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
This is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
And now, what have we learned from today's show?
That's right. What have we learned? Brought to you by Advanced Alarm, the preferred alarm and home theater provider of the Buffalo Bills. Well, we met with former Bills offensive coordinator Kevin Gilbride, who joined us on the show, and he shared some of what made him and the New York Giants successful in two Super Bowls against the Patriots.
We have never felt our team, I'm referring to, when we went into this game, that although we had great respect for them and the way they played the game and that great quarterback they had, I think we all felt that, you know, if we played as we were capable of, you know, we could win. And, you know, we played them four times and, you know, we beat them three of the four, and the one we lost was, you know, again, 38-35. They could have gone either way.
Just this hour, earlier this hour, we met with Lorenzo Alexander, who joined us on Skype. Spring practice is wrapped up. There's a six-week break now between now and the start of training camp. And the veteran linebacker talked about staying focused during the break before camp opens.
That was kind of throughout the whole offseason program. But even that last week, really that last day, just making sure that we communicated when guys come back, we need the best version of yourself. And for everybody, that's going to look a little bit differently. But at the end of the day, we're out here to win games, get to the playoffs, and win championships. So whatever it takes you to be a part of that, and your best way, you know, whether that's losing a little bit of weight, understanding the playbook a little bit better, being more consistent football player from down to down and day to day, whatever that looks like for you, just making sure that you correct all that during the 6 weeks, improve on it. So when we get back, you're not playing catch up. You're not out of shape.
And I got to say, I would think the most encouraging thing that we heard from Lorenzo was the fact that last year when I talked to him and there was problems with accountability in that locker room and putting your best product on the field, he told us there are fewer guys that are in that gray area that you have to pull out of there. And so what you should see, I think, is a more collective, accountable, consistent effort from every man on this football team when they get down to 53 in early September.
And the biggest thing he talked about with that, Chris, is that, you know, It goes back to Sean McDermott and the type of guys that he's bringing onto this team, guys that are good character guys but hardworking guys and are also good football players. And sometimes it's hard. Teams will sometimes settle on a guy that is not a character guy or a couple of guys that are not character guys just so that they can have the talent, and those guys end up sometimes pulling the team down. So it's good what Coach McDermott is doing in terms of character guys on this team.
Jonathan and Alden, we're sorry we didn't have time for you today, but he did agree with you, Donald. Chiefs game most important in his mind on this Bills schedule this year with respect to playoff hopes. So you got one guy in your corner.
That's all I need. That's all I need.
All right. Well, thanks behind the scenes to our board op at the Intercom Studios, Brayton Wilson. Production assistance provided by J.J. Torito, George Blas, Jeff Koltenak, and Thomas Hollinger. Show contributors Ryan Dukearm and Jess Pappas. Our executive producer is Jay Harris. Murph back tomorrow for Tuesday's edition of the John Murphy Show. He'll be here with Donald Jones. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.